of you, the people who love peace all over the world. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
I will never say that progress is being made. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. If you pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that's below that the below me.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Feel me, brother. Talk to me, sister.
But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever. More families in trouble. More and more people who need help but can't find it.
Struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself.
We believe that all men are created equal, yet many are denied equal
treatment. And so we say to all in this nation who dare listen to us, black, white, Jew, Gentile, Asian, Latino, that we are brothers and sisters in a long and difficult struggle.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the morning wake-up call. My name is Liz Brown. You need to get up. Ooh, yes, you need to get to me. We have so much stuff to talk about, to catch up on, to get done with. Oh, my goodness gracious. We have a lot of stuff. So you need to get up. Oh, yeah, you need to get to me. We have some amazing guests this morning, if I do say so myself. This is Monday. That means that it is the Aldermanic Watch with Alderman Lewis Reed. We have that in the 7 o'clock hour. Then we're going to talk to an actual attorney, Scott Horton, an actual attorney for Saddam Hussein, who went down there and represented Saddam Hussein. We're going to talk about that trial. Yes, we are. Was it? And we're going to talk about the execution. Murder? Justice? How do we tell? We're going to talk about that with Scott Horton. Then we're going to talk about the legacy of, what was his name? What did Nancy Pelosi call him? A man of fairness. We're going to talk about the legacy of Gerald Ford from an East Timor. Tens of thousands dead folks in East Timor. We're going to talk about that with John Miller. He's the national coordinator for the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network. We have a full morning this morning. We have a lot of stuff to catch up on. We have a lot of stuff to talk about. We have a lot of stuff to do. Oh, my goodness. 454-0400 is my phone number. 454-6609 is my fax. And my toll-free long-distance number is 1-877-920-WGNU. You need to get up. You need to get to me. We have much business to tend to. Stay with me.
Care, still connected to the community. Sometimes it seems like things are changing so fast that it's hard to keep up and hard to keep track. At ConnectCare, we want you to know that, yes, there have been some changes, and yes, we are still connected to the community. At ConnectCare, we still have a retail pharmacy open 8 to 5 Monday through Friday. At ConnectCare, we still provide transportation to patients that qualify. At ConnectCare, we still provide access to in-house laboratory services. At ConnectCare, we still provide some of the region's best board-certified doctors. At ConnectCare, we still provide urgent care. And at ConnectCare, we still see patients on a sliding fee scale. Yes, changes have been made at ConnectCare, but we're still connected to you. ConnectCare, still connected to the community.
This new year, put meeting the love of your life at the top of your list.
New Year's Eve day, I said, I'm ready for eHarmony. I decided I really wanted to find a long-term relationship.
Hi, this is Dr. Neil Clark Warren, founder of eHarmony.com. There's no experience more magical than falling in love with that one person in the world that sees you, accepts you, and loves you passionately for who you really are.
He loves me for me.
She sees me more for who I really am.
Being seen and loved for who I am is incredible.
eHarmony helped me find the love of my life.
Make this the year that it happens for you. Check out eHarmony.com and see if it feels comfortable to you. Do it now and get your personality profile free. Let's get started finding your soulmate today. eHarmony.com, because it shouldn't take a lifetime to find the love of your life.
This will be an everlasting love for me.
Just like a well-built house needs a good design and plan, so do our lives. This is Sandy.
And this is Bobby.
Two life coaches. Please join us as we take your questions about designing your life. We'll discuss life planning, following through, and the obstacles that get in the way.
This is your weekly chance to get some answers you've been looking for. We hope you'll join us on The Design Life on WGNU every Monday afternoon from 4 to 5.
Nothing can be truer than the phrase, all politics is local. That's why Liz Brown is adding the Automatic Watch to the award-winning Wake Up Calls lineup. Every Monday at 7 a.m., Liz will be joined by Alderman Lewis Reed to discuss the comings and goings of the St. Louis Board of Aldermen. Do you want to know the latest bill passed? Do you want to know why it passed? And do you want to know who voted for and who voted against? Well, you're going to have to join Liz Brown when she talks Aldermanic politics with Alderman Lewis Reed every Monday at 7 a.m. Lewis Reed is going to bring local politics up close and personal, and you never know who else will be joining the discussion. The Aldermanic Watch, every Monday at 7 a.m., only on the award-winning Wake Up Call.
This is the award-winning Wake Up Call with Liz Brown. Don't leave home without it.
Rise up, oh. Rise up, oh. Everybody gotta rise up. Come follow me, rise up, oh. Rise up, oh. They see myself got to rise up. You got to rise up, oh. Rise up, oh. Everybody gotta rise up. Yeah, that rise up, oh. Rise up, oh.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back to the Wake Up Call. My name is Liz Brown. You need to get up. You need to get to me. We have much business to tend to. 1-877-920-WGNU. Get to me. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, Liz. Welcome back.
Well, thank you.
Okay. I was wondering if you ever got my emails with the articles on Louis Farrakhan and Nancy Pelosi about what they were going to do with the troops.
Talk to me about them. I'll see if I can remember which ones they were.
Okay. Louis Farrakhan had 12 hour surgery over the weekend.
That's correct.
And then Pelosi and Reid, they told Bush no on the additional troops.
Well, we'll see if they tell them no. Okay, because actually there's nothing that I don't know of what they can do to stop him from ordering up the troops. It doesn't come to a vote on the floor of the Congress. What comes to a vote on the floor of the Congress are the spending bills. So what has to happen is that I understand and I can hear you saying we're going to challenge this. However, we got to see what you're going to do on the floor with the votes of the spend for the spending bills. I mean, so that is what has to happen. You know, it's interesting, and we're going to talk about that this week. We're going to talk about the first 100 days of this, or 100 hours of this Congress, from a perspective of people of African descent, and from a perspective of people of color, and a perspective of regular folks out there. What are these, what are the desires, what are the plans of this party in the first 100 hours, and how does it impact on all of us? And we're going to do some deconstructing this week of some of the things that the Democrats are saying out here about what they want to do. It comes down, Michael, to do they have the desire, yeah, the courage is a good word, to that's how they killed the Vietnam War. They stopped paying for it. And as long as you pay for it, and particularly, Michael, when we look at the piece that we have a military that is stretched to its limits. We have a military that's talking about we're going to go and get people that are not yet citizens. We're going to offer them citizenship. They're already recruiting people that are not healthy. They're recruiting people that are not psychologically ready. They're recruiting people that are older. They're not recruiting the best military that they could be. And we're stretched to the limit. So as long as we keep paying to put bodies out there, there will be bodies out there. Will this Congress have the courage and the vision to strangle this war and stop paying for it?
That's fair enough.
All right,
that's
Michael.
That's about all we can do.
All right.
Thank you and welcome back.
Thank you, Michael. 1-877-920-WGNU. That's 1-877-920-WGNU. You need to get up. You need to get to me. Now, here's the piece. Here is the piece. The piece. I reported to you on December 8th. That one of the final, if not the final, act of Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney was her introduction of articles of impeachment against George W. Bush. And the pieces of history that were missed on that day of December 8th, 2006, by filing these articles, George W. Bush becomes only the 10th president in the United States history to face such an action. Do you hear me? Do you hear me? Huh? Let me share with you the thing. I think it's hugely significant. I think it's hugely significant because of the silence that we have heard on this issue. The silence that we have heard on this issue. Her filing these actions makes George W. Bush only the 10th president in the history of the United States to face such charges. What were some of the charges? Let us first say that there is an addenda to the resolution introducing articles of impeachment against George Walker Bush, President of the United States, and other officials. Further actions by the President that warrant further investigation as possible grounds for impeachment are as follows. 1. Failure to ensure the laws are faithfully executed. Well, dang. Of course he doesn't do that. Of course he doesn't do that. Let me just underscore that. The charge against George Bush is failure to ensure that laws are faithfully executed. It's almost like the sun's going to rise tomorrow and George Bush is not going to make certain that the laws are executed faithfully. You want some examples of that? You want some evidence of that? Self-exemption from laws upon signing. Suspension of basic legal proceedings. Promoting an illegal war. Promoting torture. Promoting kidnapping and renditions for torture. Use of illegal weapons. Huh. Oh, yeah. I forgot. There are laws that say that you can't do that. How about this? If that one doesn't float your boat, how about this one? George Bush's failure to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. Well, no, he doesn't do that either, does he? You want examples? Suspension of due process. Unreasonable search and seizures. How about non-cooperation with Congress? How about the establishment of an unconstitutional parallel legal system? Oh, yeah, that's illegal, too. Okay, that one doesn't, you know, blow your hair back. Okay. How about this one? Failure to ensure the laws are faithfully executed. He's supposed to do that? He's supposed to do that? Oh, really? Judging from his behavior, I thought, well, maybe George Bush is just operating under the legal principle of opposite day. No, I will make certain that the laws are unfaithfully executed. Under Article 2, Section 3 of the Constitution of the United States of America, that would be right here, right now, the president has a duty to, quote, take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Ooh. George Walker Bush, during his tenure as president of the United States, has repeatedly violated the letter and the spirit of the laws and rules of criminal procedure used by civilian and military courts. He has violated or ignored regulatory codes and practices that carry out the law. He has contravened the laws governing agencies of the executive and purposes of these agencies. And in conducting the foreign affairs of the United States of America, he has proceeded in a flagrant violation of the core body of international laws to which the United States is bound by treaty. Wow. Wow. No wonder the news didn't cover this when Cynthia McKinney filed this on her way out. I don't know if many of you, and I would recommend, it's one of the things to do during this year, is go rent a movie. Okay, I love movies. I would love to talk to you about all the movies I saw while I've been on vacation. But this is one that you can go get from the video store right now. Go watch it. Since all of y'all out there just love you some Will Smith, go watch Enemy of the State. Okay? Gene Hackman, tremendous actor. Gene Hackman is in this movie. And one of the things in the movie, it's all about the government wanting to pass this wicked Telecommunications Act that would take away our civil liberties. Sound familiar? And one of the acts of the government, when they think that this person, Will Smith, has something that they want, they say we have that in order to get this thing, and Will Smith is running from him. He won't give it to him. He's being chased down by the government. So what does the government do? In order to get what they want, they destroy his reputation. They put articles in the newspaper that are not true. Headline articles in the newspaper that are not true. They send packages to his wife to help destroy destroy his relationship with his family so that he has no place to land and no place to stand while he's fighting this. What did they do to Cynthia McKinney? Shoot, if people are going to listen to her, we got to make the world think she's crazy. We got to make the world think that she's a wild card. We got to make the world think, not take her seriously. Is it life imitating art, or is it art imitating life? You need to check that movie out, Enemy of the State. Enemy of the State. And do a little deconstructing as you watch that film. Enemy of the State. Check it out. Life imitating art. Art imitating life. My name is Liz Brown. Oh, you need to stay with me because I ain't done here. I ain't done.
morning, St. Louis. 30 minutes after the hour of 6 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU. I'm Howard Morton with a look at this hour's traffic and weather. Southbound 61 between Pittman and 70. Look for an accident, and it has the ramp to eastbound 70 causing some delays of the vehicles off the roadway. Northbound 55 at 7th Street all the way into the Poplar Street entrance. Look for an accident. Right lane's blocked. That's a ramp to the Poplar Street Bridge going eastbound, so expect delays. Eastbound 40 between 141 and Mason, you've got some delays there. Eastbound 70 from Bryan through 79, there's delays. Northbound 270 from Gravois through Big Bend. Look for slow traffic as well. Gravois just east of Baptist Church, there's a report of an accident still. And eastbound 40 from Spady through McKnight, look for some delays due to traffic starting to become congested. Westbound 270 between Old Halls Ferry and West Florissant, look for some delays there as well. That is a look at this hour's traffic. Now let's take a look at this hour's weather. Windy, partly cloudy day, high around 50. This evening, partly, mostly cloudy. Windy with a low around 30. For Tuesday, blustery, colder, mostly cloudy in the morning and afternoon hours with a high around 40. And then on Wednesday, look for mostly sunny skies. They're expecting the high around 50. Currently, we have partly cloudy skies and 32 degrees. Lambert Fields reporting 31 and clouds. Stay tuned for more of Liz Brown and the award-winning Wake Up Call. It's up next. We'll take another look at your news, traffic, and weather in the 7 o'clock hour. I'm Howard Morton for AM 920 WGN.
This is Congresswoman Maxine Waters. No matter where I am in the world, I can always get the information I need from the Wake Up Call with my friend Liz Brown.
Prizes awarded on WGNU will be held for pickup at the radio station for 30 days. After 30 days, all items become the sole property of WGNU Radio to be disposed of at our discretion. In the case of event tickets, tickets will be held for 30 days or until the date of the event, whichever comes first. Prizes must be picked up at our studios, which are located at 265 Union Boulevard in St. Louis, unless otherwise specified.
This is Mitch Washington of the St. Louis office of Edward Jones, located at 200 North Broadway downtown, inviting you to tune in to Radio Free St. Louis for the WGNU Stock Market Recap, weekday afternoons immediately following the 3:30 traffic update. Find out how your investments are doing and how the numbers on Wall Street are affecting you. That's the WGNU Stock Market Recap with me, Mitch Washington, weekday afternoons at 3:30 on Radio Free St. Louis, AM 920 WGNU.
Informative, educational, provocative. This is the award-winning Morning Wake-Up Call with Liz Brown.
Welcome back to the Wake Up Call. My name is Liz Brown. You need to get up. You need to get to me. We have so much stuff to talk about. 454-0400 is the phone number. 454-6609 is my fax. Get up. Get to me. My goodness gracious, we have a ton of stuff to talk about. 454-0400 is the phone number. Get to me. Cynthia McKinney filing impeachment articles on December 5th. Major story. A major story. It should come as no surprise. And before I get back to that discussion, I want to give you a heads up on what's happening on the Wake Up Call this morning. We have, of course, in our 7 o'clock hour, our regular feature of the Automatic Watch. with Alderman Lewis Reed. That's going to be happening in the 7 o'clock hour. Then in the 8 o'clock hour, I believe what will be a fascinating discussion with a man who actually was in Baghdad, assisting on the legal team of Saddam Hussein's trial, a defense attorney. He's going to talk about the hanging of Saddam Hussein, execution, murder, justice. He's the chairman of the International Law Committee at the New York State or New York City's Bar Association, and he's a professor at the Columbia University Law School. We're going to talk about that. You're going to be amazed at this trial and about this hanging. My name is Liz Brown. This is the wake-up call. Then in the 9 o'clock hour, we will be joined by the National Coordinator for the East Timor and Indonesian Action Network, John Miller. There were lots of accolades about 90-something-year-old man, 93-year-old man who just died last week, a week before last, Gerald Ford. Much talk about that. We're going to talk about his legacy with East Timor and the thousands of people who were dead as a result of it. I was talking to a friend of mine about how some people live so long. 93 years, that's a long time. I suspect that men like Ronald Reagan, men like Gerald Ford, men like Richard Milhouse Nixon, I suspect that they live so long because they are afraid of dying and answering to the things that they have done. I suspect that they live so long because they're afraid to die. 1-877-920-WGNU. You need to get up. My name is Liz Brown. Cynthia McKinney filing articles of impeachment on December 8th, getting very little noise from the media for this, despite the fact that this is only the 10th time in history that a sitting president has had to face these articles. She filed them. They cannot be ignored now. They exist. They have to be dealt with. And one of the things that he's supposed to do is to take care that the laws are faithfully executed, really. Really? Well, then let me just share some stuff with you that you may not know. We all don't, you know, we think we know a lot, but sometimes we just don't know everything. The White House and the Secret Service quietly signed an agreement last spring. Are you feeling me on this already? The White House and the Federal Bureau of, what's that last word, Howard? What is it? What's that word? What is that word? Federal Bureau of Investigation, is that right? Ignorance? Federal Bureau of Me Know Nothing? The White House and the Federal Bureau of the Secret Service folks. They signed an agreement last spring in the midst of the Jack Abramoff. Remember him? He took down an election. They signed an agreement declaring that the records identifying visitors to the White House are no longer open to the public. Dang. Dang. Okay, we can't get into the secret meeting that Dick Cheney, who shoots his friends in the face and the heart, had with the energy people, that billions of dollars in profit they made shortly thereafter. We can't get the records of that. Now we can't. We as Americans cannot find out through public records who the visitors to the White House are. Oh, Jesus, God. And the Bush administration didn't reveal the existence of this memorandum of understanding until last fall. And, this should come as no surprise. Everything comes back around. I guess when certain things get good to you, and we've all had this life experience, you want to keep doing it more. When it gets good to you, sometimes you can't stop yourself. That's why people say when you can't stop stuff, stop doing stuff. Some folks may pull your coattail and say, it's gotten good to you, hasn't it? It's gotten good to you. Well, I guess it got good to Dick Cheney, being able to keep folks from finding out who he met with, because the White House is using this memorandum of understanding, the one that keeps the records of the people who visit the White House as secret. They're using it as a help on a ruling by a federal judge ordering the production of the Secret Service logs identifying the visitors to the office of Dick, I shoot my friends in the face and the heart, Cheney. Let me break it down so that it stays forever broke. The Washington Post is suing for access to the logs of the people that have been, you know, slipping and slithering on over to Dick Cheney's bunker. We have a right to know who visits the office of the vice president, don't we? Not if your name is Dick Cheney. I don't have to tell none of y'all jack. And so when the Washington Post sued Dick, I shoot my friends in the face and the heart, and I'll shoot you too, apparently. When the Washington Post sued to try and get these records, the White House said, oh, no, we have a memorandum of understanding with the Secret Service that none of these records are to be revealed. In the 5-page document dated May 17th, it says that all entry and exit data on White House visitors belongs to the White House as presidential records rather than the Secret Service agency public records. Therefore, the material is not subject to public disclosure under the Freedom of Information Act. Jesus. What does that mean, folks? It means that we can never find out if the man who was supposed to, and I want to be absolutely clear. Article 2, Section 3. What's that document called? Oh, yeah, the Constitution of the United States says that the president has the duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Huh. How you like me now? The president of the United States is supposed to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And I just want to reveal this for all of you fake conservative Republicans out there. It was the visitor logs that revealed the comings and goings of Monica Lewinsky with Bill Clinton. Yet and still the Democrats didn't ask that these records be kept forever secret so that nobody could ever get busted again, did they? It was but for those logs, we wouldn't have known. But for those logs, we wouldn't have known about the campaign donor Denise Rich, the wife of the fugitive financier Mark Rich, who received a pardon during the closing hours of the Clinton administration. If you don't like information, this administration says make certain it never happens again. Oh, by the way, We can't find out who's visiting you, but you got the right to open up my mail and read my stuff and listen in on my phone calls and peep me out 24/7. But I can't find out who visits you. Ain't that some stuff? Ain't that some stuff? My name is Liz Brown. Oh, I ain't done here. I ain't done here. Stay with me.
This is Lloyd Sloan, the Sloan Ranger, defending truth, fighting bad guys, and sometimes wearing a mask. A little history, a little entertainment, current events, a lot of good fun, and healthy debate. Call me, argue. If you're wrong, I will disarm you. But have no fear. The Sloan Ranger never shoots to kill. That's weekdays 5 to 6 on WGNU.
Recently in St. Louis, some changes were made in healthcare providers, and we at ConnectCare want you to know that sometimes change can be good. ConnectCare, still connected to the community. ConnectCare is now your specialty care clinic hub. If you or your loved one is dealing with kidney disease, you can contact one of ConnectCare's renal specialists at our renal clinic, dedicated to improving the quality of life and providing optimal care for patients with chronic and acute renal disease. At ConnectCare, we have 14 specialty care clinics to serve your healthcare needs. Our specialty care clinic hub includes specialty clinics dealing with arthritis, ENT, GI, orthopedics, and a women's specialty clinic. At ConnectCare, the physicians and staff at our specialty clinics are committed to the philosophy that the best care is provided by those with the greatest commitment to their community. ConnectCare, still connected to the community.
This is Judy Moskoff. Join me for A Gardener's Notebook every Monday at 12 noon on AM 920 WGNU. As a master gardener, I'll answer your questions about what grows and what doesn't, how to control annoying garden pests, and help you create colorful flower gardens and the freshest fruits and vegetables you've ever tasted. Join me, Judy Moskoff, for A Gardener's Notebook, Mondays at noon on AM 920 WGNU, where we discuss the gardening issues that matter most to you.
Nothing can be truer than the phrase, all politics is local. That's why Liz Brown is adding the Automatic Watch to the award-winning Wake Up Calls lineup. Every Monday at 7 a.m., Liz will be joined by Alderman Lewis Reed to discuss the comings and goings of the St. Louis Board of Aldermen. Do you want to know the latest bill passed? Do you want to know why it passed? And do you want to know who voted for and who voted against? Well, you're going to have to join Liz Brown when she talks Aldermanic politics with Alderman Lewis Reed every Monday at 7 a.m. Lewis Reed is going to bring local politics up close and personal, and you never know who else will be joining the discussion. The Automatic Watch, every Monday at 7 a.m., only on the award-winning Wake Up Call.
Big Brother is watching, and we're watching Big Brother on the award-winning Wake Up Call with Liz Brown.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Wake Up Call. My name is Liz Brown. You need to get up. You need to get to me. We have much business to tend to. 1-877-920-WGNU. Please don't forget, in the 9 o'clock hour today, John Miller. I'm sorry, in the 9 o'clock hour, yes, John Miller would be joining us. He's the national coordinator for the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network. We're going to be talking about Gerald Ford and his legacy with East Timor. And also, I think that there are some lessons and parallels to be made with what they did. I had an opportunity to look at some of the recently released secret documents on this. I read a discussion, a transcript of the meeting between Gerald Ford and the president of Indonesia, the dictator of Indonesia. And it's chilling to hear how casually people make agreements to slaughter other people. It will be a very interesting discussion. I'm looking forward to this with John Miller at 9 o'clock. Then in the 8 o'clock hour, we will be joined by a man who was there during the trial, an attorney that was there during the trial of Saddam Hussein. We're going to talk about that trial and the subsequent execution. What does it mean? Was it an execution? Was it murder? What kind of quote-unquote trial did Saddam Hussein get? And shouldn't we be concerned about that? And then, of course, in the 7 o'clock hour, we will be joined by Alderman Lewis Reed as we continue to discuss issues pertaining to the Board of Aldermen. This morning, we're going to be talking about crime in our community. And we're going to be talking about education and then the things that have not happened in the Board of Aldermen. We need to talk about that. And we're going to have that discussion this morning with Alderman Lewis Reed. It's a full morning on the Wake Up Call, as it should be. Let us continue on. Mac, good morning.
Well, good morning, Ms. Brown. What a beautiful day, and glad to have you back.
Thank you. Happy 007.
Sure, same to you and your family. You know, I looked at the... This wasn't a trial, it was a lynching. Let's get this right.
Mm.
This was a lynching.
Mm.
I looked into the eyes of that man during the time they was putting a rope around his neck, and I looked in the eyes of America. I saw in Texas once, they was having a football game. They drug a dummy around the thing of Bill behind a Harley Davidson motorcycle. I never could figure out that reason. They drug a man in Texas, and they hung Saddam Hussein, and then they trying to hide behind the people that had his so-called trial. America people who was behind that hanging, George W. Bush and his cronies, was deeply involved with that swift execution, hanging that man. And when you look at it, it was just a disgrace. And don't try to hide behind your kids, America, about it's so graphic until you don't think you love it. I heard people on this station call, not you. They should bring hanging back down at the arch. Hanging in this country are still alive and well in the heart of a lot of people in America. They was down with that hanging. Katie Couric, I would never watch your news again. They was so upset about when were they going to do it. What's taking them so long? Katie Couric looked the man in the eye and said, what's taking them so long? He was down with this hanging. So anyway, Miss Brown, you have a beautiful day.
Thanks for your call. During my break, and I'm not going to lie to you, it was wonderful taking a break. It's great to be back, but it was wonderful taking a break. I promised myself that I would just be chill, take some time off, do some deep breathing, and prepare myself for 007, for this new year. Slip off some old baggage, make some changes in my life with this new year. And one of the things that I wanted to do was to just, like, not watch the news. It was one of the harder things that I've done in my life, not pay attention to what was going on. Just because sometimes when I pay attention to, and all the time when I pay attention, my mind starts racing, and I get on the internet and I start doing research and I start articulating our positions in my head, and all of that. And so I tried to distance myself from that so I could have some time to be in another type of a moment. Well, this execution, this killing of, this murder of Saddam Hussein drug me back into it. And again, we're going to talk about this in the 8 o'clock hour. But I cannot let go of what I feel when I hear people embrace the killing of people. Because it's been my experience that there's no line of distinction from people that celebrate the execution of people. And a friend of mine, I was talking to him, and he was like, well, Saddam Hussein went out like a G. he did not, despite all of the things that people have said about him, and you know, and he has some conversations with God as well, as we all will. But who looked more bloodthirsty at that hanging? The man whose last words on his lips were a conversation with God, or the men that were standing there hollering, hooping and hollering, kill him, kill him, kill him, kill him, kill him, kill him. Which one looked more, which one was more troubling? Anybody that it puts me on high alert. Anybody that celebrates the execution of people. Anybody that celebrates. I'm not talking about people saying, well, good riddance to bad rubbish. I'm not talking about that. Because we all have our opinions about who should be here and who should be not be here, and who we will not miss. But I guarantee you, I would bet everything that I own, everything that I will own, that 99% of the Americans who have celebrated enthusiastically the execution of Saddam Hussein don't even know what he was on trial for. Don't even know what he was on trial for. Did you know that he was on trial for hanging people that his government tried? Did you know that? I would guarantee you, I would bet everything that I own, that over 90% of the Americans that are enthusiastic, that are high-fiving each other over the execution of Saddam Hussein, do not know what he was on trial for, let alone how the trial went down. We're going to talk about that in the 8 o'clock hour, and I'm looking forward to having that discussion with an attorney that was actually there. That was actually there. 1-877-920-WGNU. My name is Liz Brown. Coming up, The Automatic Watch with Lewis Reed. Stay with us.
It is time for us to use our power. Please do not beg for power. Nobody is going to give it to you. You were born with power.
Very sad news for all of you, the people who love peace all over the world.
Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
I will never say that progress is being made. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. If you pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that's below me.
But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever, more families.
For the issues that matter most, it's AM 920 WGNU, Granite City, St. Louis.
Here's the latest from ABC News. I'm Daria Aldinger. He's been working on them for a while, and this week we could hear President Bush's new plans for Iraq. More from ABC's Ann Compton at the White House.
When President Bush does make his recommendations midweek, its elements may sound familiar. The president has often said publicly, the way ahead must include economic and political benchmarks to include more Sunnis in the Iraq government. The new Democratic Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, says the president would have to justify any increase in U.S. forces on the ground. She's opposed, although supports expanding the overall size of the U.S. military. Ann Compton, ABC News, the White House.
Norm Orenstein with the American Enterprise Institute says debate over an issue this heated is inevitable.
The notion that you can avoid the larger politics, whether public opinion or the viewpoint of the opinion leaders who actually cast their votes, is simply false.
There were more lives lost in Baghdad today. Gunmen opened fire on a bus carrying workers to the city's airport. At least 9 were killed, 11 hurt. The president and the Democratic-led Congress may have an easier time reaching a compromise on the minimum wage. The last increase was 10 years ago to $5.15 an hour.
If you are one of these folks who's unfortunate enough to be dependent on the buying power of the minimum wage, you're 20-25% worse off than you were 10 years ago, the last time Congress addressed this issue.
Jared Bernstein with the Economic Policy Institute. The snow has stopped falling in Colorado, but drivers are still being slowed by ground blizzards. Winds up to 89 miles an hour stirred up fresh snow and created whiteout conditions. It's cleanup time after storms ripped through parts of Georgia overnight.
The doors were flung wide open and rain and debris were coming in, and I heard metal ripping, and I hollered at the customers to get in the cooler, and I locked us in the cooler until it was over.
The area was hit by tornadoes last week. ABC News.
Feels like I get this same cold every year. So I got the same nighttime medicine I always get. But I was congested all night, so it wasn't the same.
Many cold medicines have changed. NyQuil Cold Flu Relief no longer has a decongestant. New Tylenol Cold Nighttime does. It helps relieve more of your worst cold symptoms, and it helps you sleep. It's one more step towards a pain-free world. Stop. Think. New Tylenol Cold. Take only as directed.
When was the last time you got a second chance to save thousands of dollars? If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, American Tax Relief is offering you a second chance to eliminate up to 85% of your delinquent taxes. Look, your tax problem could get worse unless you get help. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation. You could save up to 85% on your delinquent taxes. Call 800-539-9208. That's 800-539-9208.
A word of advice to parents: make sure your girls eat well and get plenty of exercise while they're in their tween years. ABC's Daniela Bellotta tells us why.
Girls are more likely to become overweight between the ages of 9 and 12. The study by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, however, does not say why. Nutritionist Ava Obarzanek says there are several underlying factors.
We have this societal, background upon which, there are exposures to perhaps too little physical activity, too large portion sizes.
The study also found chubby tween girls were already seeing their blood pressure and cholesterol levels inch up. Daniela Bellotta, ABC News.
He's too old to be fired, at least by Donald Trump, and now a New Hampshire man is taking the billionaire host of The Apprentice to court. 49-year-old Joseph Hewitt says his age was the only thing that kept him off the show. I'm Daria Albinger, ABC News.
Now, the local report from the WGNU Newsroom.
With this hour's WGNU News Update, I'm Peyton Colston. In the news, a Mizzou professor has a new book on the landmark civil rights murder case of Emmett Till. Dr. Clenora Hudson Weems says Till, a 14-year-old from Chicago lynched in rural Mississippi in August of 1955, is as important a figure as any in the civil rights movement. She calls Dr. Martin Luther King the father of the movement and Rosa Parks the mother.
But you must also look at the one who was responsible for making that movement come to the forefront, and that was Till. So Emmett Till is the child of the movement. It's a trinity. It's the father, the mother, and the child.
Dr. Clenora Hudson Weems' new book is The Definitive Emmett Till. Professor Weems was a recent guest on WGNU's Rasta Resolutions with Carlos Vinson. Now a couple notes from the Normandy School District. Training for the OASIS Intergenerational Tutoring Program is scheduled for Monday and Tuesday, January 22nd and 23rd, 8:30 a.m. till 12:30 p.m. at the Normandy Board of Education on Lucas and Hunt Road. OASIS pairs older adults with students in first through third grade to assist the students in reading skills. Most tutors volunteer 1 hour per week. The number for more information is 314-493-0140. Normandy Senior High School announces the ACT 21 Club for the 2006-2007 school year. The 21 Club started last year to recognize students who scored 21 or better on the ACT College Entrance Exam. Members this time around are Bill Bell, Camelia Blount, Jasmine Campbell, Jolene Hibbler, Kevin Johnson, Carissa Oliver, Kriana Pai, LT Robinson, Adam Smith, Melissa Vasquez, and Clarissa Rankins. I'm Peyton Colston, and that's a WGNU News Update.
Good morning, St. Louis. 6 minutes after the hour of 7 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU, I'm Howard Morton. Let's take a look at this hour's traffic and weather. Southbound 61 at Route A and 70, look for stop-and-go traffic due to an accident. Left lane's blocked, and it's on east, the ramp to eastbound 70. Northbound 55 from Arsenal through 44, you've got slow traffic. Eastbound 44 from Soccer Park through 270, it is slow as well. Northbound Route 3 from 8th Street onto the Poplar Street Bridge, that ramp is slow. Westbound Kingbridge traffic from the Gravel Pit into the Landing looks good. Westbound 5570 from 3rd Street into the PSB looks like you've got some slow traffic going on there as well. Westbound 270 from Old Halls Ferry to West Florissant is on the move. Eastbound 40 between 141 and Mason, and then again from Spady through McKnight, expect delays. Eastbound 70 from Bryan Road through 79, look for slow traffic out there. Northbound 270 from Graboy through Big Bend is slow, especially around the 44 interchange. And westbound 40 between McCausland and Hanley, look for traffic to be building there. That is a look at this hour's traffic. Now let's take a look at your weather forecast for today, tomorrow, and for Wednesday. Partly cloudy, windy today with a high around 50. This evening, windy, mostly cloudy, low around 30. Then moving on to Tuesday, blustery skies, colder, mostly cloudy in the morning, becoming partly cloudy throughout the day with a high around 40. And then for this evening, or for Wednesday, look for mostly sunny skies. The expected high is around 50 degrees. Currently, we have 31 degrees and clouds. Stay tuned for more of the award-winning Wake Up Call with your host, Liz Brown. She's up next. We'll be back at the bottom of the hour with more traffic and your weather. I'm Howard Morton for AM 920 WGNU.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Tell me, brother, how can you discern? I think I'm hearing revolution in the air.
It is time for us to use our power. Please do not beg folks for power. Nobody is going to give it to you. You were born with power.
Some very sad news for all of you. People who love peace all over the world. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
I will never say that progress is being made. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. If you pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that's below me.
I'm hearing
revolution in the air. Tell me, brother, stop resisting.
But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever, more families in trouble, more and more people who need help but can't find it.
Struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself.
We believe that all men are created equal, yet many are denied equal treatment.
And so we say to all in this nation who dare listen to us, black, white, Jew, Gentile, Asian, Latino, that we are brothers and sisters in a long and difficult struggle.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to another edition of the Aldermanic Watch. I am here with Alderman Lewis Reed. Mr. Reed, good morning.
Good morning, Liz.
How are you?
Great, great.
There are a couple of things that I think that we need to have some conversations about as a member of the Board of Aldermen, because you all impact us on some of these issues. And before we get to those two issues, I just want you to remind folks of who you are, you know, who you represent, and what the role of an alderman is in the Board of Aldermen, and what the role of a president of the Board of Aldermen is.
Okay. I'm Lewis Reed. I currently represent the 6th Ward, which is in the central corridor of the city and includes, you know, several neighborhoods, Lafayette Square, Compton Heights, Tower Grove East, the downtown west area, parts of Fox Park, and an area called the Gate District. The boundaries run roughly from Dr. Martin Luther King to Gravois, mm-hmm. On the north and south boundaries. And then it goes roughly from Compton to about 18th Street, but it fluctuates in and out between those two streets throughout the entire district. I'm the alderman of the 6th Ward, and the members of the Board of Aldermen, they are the legislative branch of city government, so they handle any of the legislation that comes before the city, everything from stop signs to passing laws and, you know, for street changes, stop signs, street vacations, to development projects, anything that would happen with development, zoning issues, they get involved in zoning issues.
How about public safety?
Public safety, they have quite a bit to do with public safety also. And then they you know, they manage that, your tax dollars in terms of directing the budget.
Now also one of the things that you say, you talk about the legislative piece, the writing of the laws and the writing of the ordinances comes from that legislative body, but you also are able to impact on public sentiment by virtue of something called resolutions. You're able
yes.
to do that. Talk to us about what a resolution is.
A resolution, you know, basically, you know, establishes a position for mm-hmm. the board. So we can pass a resolution to say that the Board of Aldermen is, you know, against or for a certain thing.
For example, we had a unanimous decision that came out of the Board of Aldermen not too long ago about the death penalty.
Yes.
So basically the Board of Aldermen, through their resolutions, can be like a bully pulpit for public sentiment.
It certainly can, and you know, resolutions are passed all the time mm-hmm. to establish a position for the board. You know, if we want to send a message to the state legislature, or if we want to send a message to the federal government, or if we want to just tell the public how we feel as a board, pass resolutions.
And how you're representing your constituents. This is our, sometimes it's a line in the sand, and sometimes it's something as simple as, I want to recognize somebody in my ward that has done something remarkable, and we want everybody to know about that.
Exactly right.
So, right. And what does it take to do a resolution?
You introduce it at the board. There are two types of resolutions. It's what we call a courtesy resolution, where we can do something like recognize somebody for their contributions in the community, recognize them on their birth date, all kinds of things mm-hmm. of that nature. And under those resolutions, you would bring them before the Board of Aldermen, and they do not require a committee hearing. All right. Then there's the other type of resolution where we would actually may require additional discussion, and with that type of resolution, it would be assigned to a committee. A committee hearing would be held, and then the public would also have an opportunity to come and weigh in on that resolution.
Well, we'll be back. I'm talking to Alderman Lewis Reed. My name is Liz Brown. This is the Aldermanic Watch. Stay with us. Dr. Laura Schlesinger. Tune in AM 920 WGNU every Monday through Friday from 2 till 4. Dial 1-800-DR-LAURA, then go do the right thing.
Hi, it's Kevin.
And Sue McCarthy.
Of the Travel Planner Show.
Before you head out for a trip, you want to know how to pack, so check weather at yahoo.com, and then you'll know what to wear when you get there.
Oh, she's so good. The Travel Planner Show, every Saturday afternoon from 2 to 4 here on AM 920 WGNU.
Previously on the Lone Ranger program.
How come we don't call the government nuts? Because they have sometimes outlandish conspiracy stories. When the government does it, apparently it's okay, but when anybody else does it, then it's wacky. Speaking of that, how come Hillary wasn't called a nutcase for her vast right-wing conspiracy theory that allegedly explained the Monica Lewinsky affair, and nobody ever called her a conspiracy nut, which is exactly what should have happened, should have been laughed off the Today Show.
For the smartest talk on radio, it's the Sloan Ranger Show, weekdays at 5 o'clock, only on AM 920 WGNU.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Davis, home mortgage consultant with Wells Fargo.
And I'm Jacques Land with the 100 Black Men of Metropolitan St. Louis.
And we're the hosts of Let's Get Wealthy, investing in more ways than one. We'll discuss home ownership as a means to build wealth, create positive personal finances, stabilize our neighborhoods, and acquire the American dream.
Tune into our show, Let's Get Wealthy, every Wednesday at 11 a.m. to get some food for thought during your lunch hour. Sponsored by the 100 Black Men of Metropolitan St. Louis, Wells Fargo Housing Foundation, and produced by the Platinum Group.
Informative, educational, provocative. This is the award-winning Morning Wake-Up Call with Liz Brown.
Turn on the television. I'm watching Martin Luther King, who had a dream. Oh, so take this dream and apply it to your life. Even though we know the ghetto's rough. But we got to keep your head up.
I'll keep your head up.
Cause a new day will come. And love to the sun. Even when the darkness shall come.
Oh. Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back to the Wake Up Call. My name is Liz Brown. This morning I am joined, because it's Monday morning at 7 o'clock, I am joined by Alderman Lewis Reed. And this is the Aldermanic Watch. And we're talking about the Board of Aldermen and some issues that are percolating through our community. And Lewis, on our way out, we were talking about resolutions and how those can effectively be like a bully pulpit for the Board of Aldermen. They don't have the weight of law, but they certainly have the ability to frame public opinion, to make it clear to the public about the stance that the legislators are taking on a particular issue. And I think that that's very important. Can we talk about education right now? Yeah, mm-hmm. Because that is an issue that I was in Jefferson City for the swearing-in ceremony of some of our legislators, and some of the elected officials there, some of the state representatives there, then on the majority side of the aisle, were talking about how education was going to be one of their big issues, and there were some comments made alluding to what was going on in the city of St. Louis and the Board of Education. does the St. Louis Board of Aldermen have any do they have the ability to weigh in on the St. Louis Public Schools from a legislative perspective?
Yes, the way they would weigh in on the legislative perspective on the, as it relates to the Board of Education, is a couple ways. You know, they can, you know, pass, like we talked about earlier, pass resolutions that clearly state their position. You know, if their position is to, support a specific role or support a specific position of one entity or another, they can pass a resolution to do that from the Board of Aldermen. The other thing that they can do is to convene public hearings. So they can, you know, go through the process of that also, just for information purposes only.
Well, recently we had a decision that came down, not a decision, but a group of people that were appointed by people in the state by DESE, Kent King, to weigh in on the St. Louis Public Schools. They weren't elected. There was no public hearing held on who the people were supposed to be on this. They were just appointed. And they had a recommendation. And their recommendation was that the St. Louis Board of Election, and these are elected people, you run for office to be a member of the Board of Aldermen, and you run citywide, that their recommendation basically is that those people no longer have any authority, that the authority of the St. Louis Public Schools would now be in the hands of three people appointed by the governor's office, the mayor's office, and the president of the Board of Aldermen in the city of St. Louis. what is your take on such a recommendation, that you'd have a three-person board superseding elected officials?
The elected officials. I think that one of the things we have to look at is, you know, of course, if that was to happen, or if we were going down that road, anything was going to happen, is take a look at, you know, making sure we do not, you know, prematurely do anything that would take the power out of the elected officials' hands.
Well, prematurely, I mean, isn't this basically voter nullification? If you're an elected official, if you run for president of the Board of Aldermen, you do a citywide run and you win. Mm-hmm. And then the state of Missouri says, you know what, we don't like the behavior of the aldermen in the city of St. Louis. We don't like the things that they're doing there. Let us, we're going to recommend that there's a three-person board. One person doesn't live in the city of St. Louis. Two people live in the city of St. Louis. They would decide what you, as president of the Board of Aldermen, should do. Well, the voters voted for you to be president of the Board of Aldermen. Isn't that kind of like a voter nullification piece?
Yes, that, you know, in essence, you can look at it that way, that it would be a voter nullification, that, you know, the people that the voters hired to do the job, have that job has been removed from them.
Mm-hmm. And when you went to the polls to vote, so it's kind of like when the voters go to the poll to vote for their school board members, actually the voters' decision is being taken away. It's being nullified because all of the decisions are going to be made by somebody that nobody voted for.
That's true.
So let's talk about that from the Board of Aldermen's position. As a member of the Board of Aldermen, what can a member do on an issue like this? Can they?
Well, what they can do, a couple things. Mm-hmm. All right, if you, the first thing again is what we talked about in terms of a resolution to bring some attention to the issue, to talk about, you know, the issue, just like we've done here. And the whole public hearings on it. Mm-hmm. You know, they can ask for a committee hearing for that resolution, and then it can go to committee, and then we can have a clearly stated position from our legislative branch city.
Let me do it this way. You're president of the Board of Aldermen. You have seen this recommendation coming down saying that we want these three people to control the St. Louis Public Schools rather than the elected officials. What would you do as the president of the Board of Aldermen?
Well, a couple things. You know, as the president of the Board of Aldermen, I would have been engaged in the process a lot earlier than now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would have, you know, had a a public position on this thing a long time ago, mm-hmm. Being able to see what has transpired through time. I would also, as president of the Board of Aldermen, be taking a going through convening some public hearings so that we can get to the root of how the public feels about this mm-hmm. issue. Because at the end of the day, it's about the kids. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about education. We need to make sure that we continue to strip politics out of this issue at every turn. We could be, and again, convening hearings, passing resolutions, being involved in the process. And then, you know, taking a look at, I think it's also important to take a look at if it comes down to this three-member panel, right, and this is going to happen, and it's out of our control, and it's absolutely going to happen, so we pass the resolutions, we get the resolutions in, we have a clearly stated position.
In opposition to this.
In opposition to it, but also taking a look at who that person would be. Being appointed by the president of the Board of Aldermen is also key, because that person can be somebody that's purely political, that has political ties and things of that nature, that will not, at the end of the day, have the best interests of the kids in mind. Or that person can be somebody that has the interest, purely the interest of the kids in mind. And I think that that's one of the things that we should be asking our president now. Who are you going to appoint?
Well, shouldn't we first be asking him what his position is on this three-person board? Shouldn't we first be asking him, do you believe in voter nullification? Shouldn't we first be asking him, what is the board's position
of course, all of that, and that's what I was talking about earlier when I was talking about you know, passing of the resolutions, taking an early position on the issue, going back to the beginning of when this thing started to happen. If you're the head of the legislative branch of the government, you have an opportunity to do those things. Mm-hmm. That's part of your job. You're up there with the mayor and the comptroller and everybody else and looking at these issues. So, that there should have been an early engagement in this process.
And also, shouldn't the public be concerned about, it's my understanding that there has been a meeting by Jim Shrewsbury, meeting with Francis Slay on this issue of whether of this three-person board.
Okay.
Talk about that, who the people should be on that board, a private meeting between the two of them. Isn't that a little? Shouldn't the citizens be a little bit concerned about?
Being a parent, mm-hmm. right, and having to rely on your kids to be educated in the St. Louis City Public Schools, and understanding that this three-member board is coming in, they're going to take over. It is that choice is intensely critical.
Mm-hmm.
Again, depending on who those three people are, if it's purely political, this thing will erupt like crazy, and this whole school will be dismantled. But I will tell you, I did not hear that they mm-hmm. they've been meeting
mm-hmm.
on this. But
mm-hmm. and the other piece of it is that it's jumping the gun, because if you're already meeting, it's like you've already thrown in the towel and saying, okay, this is what's going to happen, and not a single hearing has been held.
That's a very good point. At this point, again, some of the things that should be happening, by our leader of the legislative branch of city government is convening those hearings, doing those resolutions, doing everything you can to assure that at the end of the day, the focus remains on the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the focus has to remain on the kids through this process.
And also the voters. Shouldn't the focus also be on respecting what the voters have said? The voters have voted for a Board of Education, and shouldn't that be paramount too?
That should be paramount also.
We're going to take a break. This is Liz Brown. And Lewis, if there were a resolution introduced on the floor of the Board of Aldermen saying just that the voters' right, that the voters' vote should be respected, would you be in support of that?
I'd be in support of it.
And we're going to take a break. This is Liz Brown. Stay with us.
morning, St. Louis. 29 minutes after the hour of 7 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU. I'm Howard Morton. Let's take a look at your traffic and your weather. Northbound 55 at Arsenal and 44. Look for slow traffic. Eastbound 44 from Soccer Park through 270. Expect some delays. Northbound Route 3 from 8th Street, that ramp onto the top of the Poplar Street Bridge, you can expect delays. Westbound Kingbridge traffic from the Gravel Pit through Laclede's Landing looks good. Westbound 270 from Old Halls Ferry into West Florissant. Expect no problems there. Eastbound 40 between 141 and Mason and then Spady through McKnight. You can expect some tie-ups due to traffic rolling into the downtown area. Eastbound 70 from Bryan Road through 79. It is a slow go. Eastbound 270 at Washington Elizabeth all the way into West Florissant. Expect for some delays due to accidents at West Florissant. And northbound 270 at Tesson Ferry and Big Bend, that accident's been cleared north of 44 in the left center lane, but expect some residual delays. Westbound 5570 at 4th Street into the PSB, look for some slowdowns as well as you're getting that final push into the morning rush hour. Northbound 270 from Dorset through the 70 exit, look for slowdowns in the right 70 exit lanes. That is a look at this hour's traffic. Now let's take a look at your weather for today, tomorrow, and for Wednesday. Windy, partly cloudy, high around 50. This evening, mostly cloudy. Windy with a low around 30. Tuesday, blustery skies, colder, mostly cloudy in the morning, partly cloudy in the afternoon. A high expected around 40. Then on Wednesday, mostly sunny. They're expecting highs around 50, but we'll see. Currently at the studios of AM 920 WGNU, we have 31 degrees. Lambert Field is reporting 31 as well. Stay tuned for more of Liz Brown and the award-winning Wake Up Call. That's up next. We'll take another look at your news, traffic, and weather in the 8 o'clock hour. I'm Howard Morton for AM 920 WGNU.
This New Year, put meeting the love of your life at the top of your list.
New Year's Eve day, I said, I'm ready for eHarmony. I decided I really wanted to find a long-term relationship.
Hi, this is Dr. Neil Clark Warren, founder of eHarmony.com. There's no experience more magical than falling in love with that one person in the world that sees you, accepts you, and loves you passionately for who you really are.
He loves me for me.
She sees me more for who I really am.
Being seen and loved for who I am is incredible.
eHarmony helped me find the love of my life.
Make this the year that it happens for you. Check out eHarmony.com and see if it feels comfortable to you. Do it now and get your personality profile free. Let's get started finding your soulmate today. eHarmony.com, because it shouldn't take a lifetime to find the love of your life.
This will be an everlasting love for me.
Hello, I'm John Womack. I have a new show on WGNU called On the Table. Some of the things we'll talk about will be restaurants, food and wine trends, recipes, but really, we're just trying to help you experience great food and wine, whether you're at home or out on the town. So if you love great food and wine, you'll love On the Table. Be listening every Tuesday at noon here on WGNU.
Anywhere in the world at WGNU.net, the award-winning Wake Up Call with Liz Brown.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back, welcome back to the Aldermanic Watch. My name is Liz Brown. I am here with Alderman Lewis Reed. And Alderman, one of the things that that is really percolating out there in the community is the issue of crime. Talk to us about what a alderman can do with respect to that and some of the things that you would like to see done, because we had a shooting just was it last week or the week before of a young man by the police. His funeral actually is going to be tomorrow. And you're going to be going to that?
Yes.
And we need to talk about what the community can expect from the Board of Aldermen with respect to crime and public safety. Talk to us about that.
Well, in respect to crime and public safety, the Board of Aldermen, they work very closely with the police department to target specific areas in terms of, fighting drug dealing, prostitution, and things of that nature. We also work with the police department to open up, police substations, and things throughout the community to target specific areas. There's also a program called the MAP program, Management Assistance Program, but that program has been extended throughout the years to include a lot of nuisance properties and crime-related issues. So what your alderman can do is fund the MAP program and hire what we call a MAP coordinator. And that MAP coordinator will go throughout the community and work in targeted areas as requested by the community or requested by the alderman. And what that MAP coordinator will do is they'll go out and help target, specific areas and try to get rid of the prostitution, the drugs, the graffiti on the walls, all those types of things, along with working with problem properties and nuisance properties and getting rid of anything that falls under that realm of a public or community nuisance. Mm-hmm. Would be able to be addressed by that MAP coordinator.
And in terms of the public perspective of crime in the community and crime in the city of St. Louis, as an older person, what are you feeling out there from the citizens?
I'm feeling there's been a spike in crime all across our city.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be there's several different schools of thought on why we have that spike in crime all across our city. A lot of people say that it has to do with us finding better, more things to do with our young people, so that they're not just out in the streets hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
People say it has to do with parents having to have two jobs now.
Mm-hmm.
To pay their bills, so they're not there in the evenings. Mm-hmm. And the kids are left on their own,
unsupervised.
Mm-hmm. And then what we end up having is a lot of car, what they call car cloudings, where,
mm-hmm.
A lot of busted windows and people are taking the things, whatever, left out on the seats of the cars, and a lot of car thefts, a lot of break-ins and things of that nature. So that's been a spike all across our city.
Well, can I just stop you just for a second here? When we talk about youth and places for youth to go, as the president of the Board of Aldermen, or if you were in charge of the Board of Aldermen, and as an older person, talk to us. One, as an older person, how much of a focus you've had on finding alternative things for kids to do to keep them occupied and to keep them with having good choices and not just bad choices to make. And secondly, if you were in a leadership position in the Board of Aldermen, as president of the Board of Aldermen, what priority would that be on your agenda?
Well, that would be a big priority. Some of the things that we've done that I've worked on throughout my community is work to support after-school programs. Number one, so that we can, so that the kids have some place to go after school for an extended period of time, so they're just not let out at 3, their parents get home at 5, and what do they do for that 2 or 3 hours? I mean, that's been a problem in the community. The other thing that I've worked on is trying to assure that the community centers within the 6th ward receive the funding that they need to receive, so that the community center can continue their outreach efforts.
Mm-hmm.
To bring those kids in so that they can play basketball, do artwork and those types of things. And it's putting them to work in a constructive manner.
Mm-hmm.
So that you're occupying that free time, so that they do not have the time to get into trouble.
And the other piece of it also is it comes back to the school piece of it, creating an environment in our schools and having people that run our schools and in charge of our schools, creating the type of environment that kids want to be part of, and also providing the schools with the after-school support that they need for the kids as well.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And there's so much more we can be doing with our education system in terms of, working with the kids, at 3 o'clock or 3:30 when they let out of school, to keep them occupied, keep them engaged in a more constructive manner of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly something as president of the Board of Aldermen you could be working on with the Board of Education. Not that you can direct them to say you have to do this, but you can be working on it in the same way I've worked on it in my ward, by working on it with other aldermen, talking to them about working with these after-school programs and things of that nature.
Now, one of the issues that has come up on the issue of public safety is the question of a civilian review board.
Yeah.
We again, with the shooting of this young man, there are many people within the community that are renewing their call for a civilian review board in order to be able to investigate things like this. Is that important for the city of St. Louis to have an independent civilian review board or oversight board?
It's important from a couple of different standpoints. One of the things, if you talk to the average person out there, the average person out there, I don't think has an axe to grind against the police department, mm-hmm. but the average person out there does feel like they want some say so, or they want a vehicle to make sure that their concerns are heard to the police department, and that's a good place where a civilian review board can come in handy in making that linkage between the police department and the community. The police department has been good about sending representatives out to the neighborhood meetings, so that at the neighborhood meetings you have an opportunity to talk to a police officer, tell them what your problems are, and hopefully get those problems addressed. But there is a large group of people out there that do not attend those neighborhood mm-hmm. meetings because of work issues or whatever, that would like to have some other way to let their opinions be known to the police department, and that's where a civilian review board comes in very handy.
And also in terms of the independence of it, because I know as an attorney that there should be an independent review place of attorneys' actions, because oftentimes, attorneys will protect other attorneys or feel that they need to protect other attorneys, and you need that kind of an independent input into what happens.
Exactly. And that's the second round. And I said, for a couple of different reasons. One of them was just a public opinion. The other thing is to feel like there is some fair and open process.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another good place where a civilian review board will play in.
Unfortunately, you have to run to a meeting. You're gonna have to make these 15 minutes up at another time, okay, Lewis?
I would be happy to.
Okay, we're gonna take a break. We will be back. Stay with us.
Affordable health insurance. Finding affordable health insurance for you and your family, it's on everyone's mind right now. If you're self-employed, it's on your mind too. One of the things we face as entrepreneurial Americans is finding affordable health insurance. Well, I've found a company you can call right now and get affordable health insurance. Midwest National Life Insurance Company of Tennessee. Write this number down. 877-652-7793. That's 877-652-7793. Midwest specializes in helping entrepreneurs of all kinds. Those of us who run small businesses or don't get health insurance where we work, to protect our families with affordable health insurance. Call 877-652-7793. Not available in all states. Association membership is required in most states. Home office, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Exclusions and limitations apply.
Hi, I'm Laurie Fulkerson, inviting you to join me every Monday morning at 10 on AM 920 WGNU. You'll hear stories of people just like you who are overcoming obstacles and making the difference in the lives of others. You're invited to share your thoughts. You know people are what matter most to me, and I enjoy talking with you and helping you reach your highest goals. Join me for the Laurie Fulkerson Show, Monday morning at 10 on AM 920 WGNU. We're here to discuss what matters most to you.
Around the world, behind the story. It's the award-winning wake-up call with Liz Brown.
Love makes me treat you the way that I do. Gee, baby, ain't I good to you? There's nothing too good for a boy, that's so true. Gee, baby, ain't I good to you?
Welcome back to the Wake Up Call. My name is Liz Brown. We have much to talk about. 1-877-920-WGNU. That's 1-877-920-WGNU. And Lewis Reed has left the office, but Irene J. Smith has joined us here on the air. And I want to continue the conversation that we were having with Lewis Reed. First of all, good morning, Irene.
Good morning, Liz, and the listening audience.
Lewis Reed was talking about a civilian oversight bill. When you were on the Board of Aldermen, what did you see in terms of support of this civilian review board?
First of all, initially, all of the African-American aldermen, including Lewis Reed, right away supported the civilian review bill that Terry Kennedy introduced. At that time, there was a split right along racial lines in terms of supporting a civilian review board. I saw a lot of work being put into it, Terry Kennedy and others trying to work through, get a bill that was independent and at the same time a bill that could get passed, because as you know, it took 15 votes to get it passed.
And I think that one of the things that it's real important right now at this juncture, Irene, to talk about the need for a civilian review board in light of what has happened to a young man, a baby, by the name of Jeremy. Talk to us about that.
You know, on the Friday after Christmas, there was a shooting in the 5500 block, actually a murder, in my opinion, based upon the statements that we have obtained from eyewitnesses, in which a police officer, from our account, killed a child. It did not have a weapon. Actually, based upon the information we have received, the police officer actually threw down a weapon, but he shot the kid in the back several times and then kicked him over and shot him again. In the process, between kicking him over, before he kicked him over, he dropped an object out of his pocket. The people were honest that they didn't see exactly because the officer was trying to cover with his body. But then after he moved, there was a gun on the ground, and he shot the young man again several times.
What's the name of this cop?
It's my understanding, based on sources, we do not know this, I don't have documentation, but based on sources, the name of the shooter was Officer Nathaniel Burkamper. Mm. That's what I have been told. As you know, today police reports have not, even preliminary reports.
Now that's significant, the fact that there have been no preliminary reports at this time. We're both criminal,
exactly.
I'm a former criminal defense attorney. You get the preliminary report because that's the eyewitness report.
Right. This is the police officer who was on the scene. Normally you would have the preliminary report completed, then it would be turned over to the detective bureau or whatever, should the circumstances dictate. And, you know, the press has been asking for the reports, and they keep, at least the press that I've been in contact with, they've indicated that the report is not ready. You know, is my understanding that there were reports to me that Chief Mulqua said that this kid was not shot in the back. That is absolutely untrue. And I know that because I saw the body. We had an independent pathologist to look at the body, to look at the gunshot wounds. I was present at the time when that happened.
And let's back up just 1 second, because the thing that is most chilling to me, Irene, is first of all, the city of St. Louis was number one in crime, okay? And the response from this mayor's office was the guy that gave the report lives with his grandma in his basement. That was their response, as opposed to taking seriously what this report was saying. And in response to that, at first the initial rejection of it, and then the tepid response, and then the chilling response from Joe Mulqua. Joe Mulqua said that we're going to take the gloves off.
And it's interesting because it was reported to me by the grandmother of Jeremy that when she said, why did he have to shoot him? Why did he kill, you know, why did he kill my baby? Why did he kill my grandson? And she said Joe Mulqua's response to her was, our officers are trained to kill.
Jesus, God.
She said, he said it right there. The baby's body is still there, still warm.
Jesus, God.
And he said, his response to her is not that we're going to investigate this. We're going to make sure that everything is covered. We're going to see what happened in this incident. First of all, he's on the television. And I saw him say it was a justifiable homicide because there was a gun down. Okay? He tells the grandmother of the victim that
we're supposed to shoot to kill. Jesus, no, you're not.
My officers are trained to kill. They are trained to kill. That was his response. And she has said that repeatedly. That this resonates so in her spirit. And, you know, she said, you know, this is my grandson. You know, a child who just come from goody goodies eating breakfast, was getting ready to go to the store with someone, to a convenience store.
A good kid, a sweet kid, a kid that carried people's groceries without, I don't want no money for that. I'm just doing this because it needs to be done. A sweet, wonderful kid. And this, the chief of police says to the grandma, our job is to kill y'all.
You know, we have one, this has devastated one witness that we're trying to locate, because she was there along with her son, two other witnesses that we know for sure. And there were others, because this happened basically on a lot. And there are a lot of different vantage points for which individuals could have seen what happened. This woman has not been back to her house. She was howling and screaming. One sister who was on the scene that saw this, you know, she's so precious. She's like, stop shooting him. I mean, she was headed across the street.
Without her shoes on.
Without it. Saying, stop shooting him. You know, he don't have a gun. He's in a freeze position. And, you know, and a bunch of superlatives, because she was very upset. She was casting the cops, said, get away. This is a crime scene. You better back off. This
I guess
is a crime
is.
Scene.
He just got finished killing
you know?
Somebody.
And then what was interesting is that reports that we have heard that statements of police officers about attending this baby's funeral, and that this is a high-level gang killing. They say, lady asked me, well, how could it be a high-level gang killing as the police
killed him?
I said, you know what? What you speak is what it is.
Gang members do wear blue. The police chief said, our officers are trained to shoot to kill. What does that say about the environment that we then are living in? If the cops look at us and say, if I shoot you, it's my intention to kill you dead.
I mean, first, it's a very repressive environment. I'm going to tell you why it's so important that this case, as all others, and as all others, be brought to justice. Because these kids are saying, this was Jeremy wasn't into nothing. He was a good kid. You know, if the police can get away with murdering, executing, assassinating this kid, man, you know,
none of us are safe.
None of us are safe. And those who, you know, like on the fringes are not doing right, okay, they out there. They like, who? I'm going to strap down, because if the police tell me to stop, I ain't stopping, because they ain't going to do nothing but kill me, so I may as well take my chances. So then we create an environment that is even more hostile.
But you know what?
Repressive.
This kind of segues into the guest that I'm having in my next hour. I'm going to have in a man by the name of Scott Horton, who was actually an attorney during Saddam Hussein's trial. And I look at the execution of Saddam Hussein by this administration, as a provocative act, an act that was used intentionally to stir up chaos and to stir up animosity and to stir up people to fight back in order that George Bush can do what he wants to do in that environment. Do you see this type of actions or these types of activities also like that, Irene, that they are when you tell community members, a grieving grandmother, when she's asking you why my baby's dead, you're telling her we shoot to kill. When you have cops that are saying we're coming to this funeral, we're going to be there because we want everybody to see us and to be afraid or to be or respond to our presence, do you see that as a provocative act?
Of course it is, because these kids and young adults, they are most upset about this killing, okay? So to come there in that manner is definitely something that would provoke them. You know, when you see kids, you know, you see the memorials that they set up for Jeremy, and you see folks saying, you know, forget the police, F the police, you know? And then you come, you have the nerve to come to the funeral?
And come in a dishonest and disingenuous and a provocative and an intentional way to say something about this baby's death that is not true. And if you say that this is about gangs, some people will turn away from the investigation of this, not look any further.
Exactly.
So you're making two statements. You're being provocative, hoping that you start some stuff. And then secondly, you're saying this is just another gang type of a thing. This baby was shot in the back by a cop who kicked his body over and came back and pumped more bullets in that baby's body.
Yes, absolutely correct.
What's the gang
and
in
you know,
this?
People say, you know, Irene, how you know? I know because I saw the body. Yes, it had been brought from the morgue. I saw the body.
And check this out. Irene, tell the audience about the body. The body was taken to the mortuary. You saw the body. Then what happened?
Then the next day, I received a phone call that the medical examiner's office was coming back to pick up the body.
They're coming to examine. The cops are coming to examine the body again? What does that tell you? The medical examiner.
The medical examiners. You know, initially people, you know, first of all, I had never heard of them taking the body back. But on further investigation, mortuaries are telling me that happens quite often. You know, that they will release the body. And in Jeremy's situation, they had called the funeral home two or three times saying that the body was released. The mortuary would go down. They would say, no, it's still a hold on the body. So then when they finally released the body, you know, the body gets to the mortuary. Then, you know, we have a pathologist. In fact, we had just gotten in from Jeff City, mm-hmm. You know. And the next day, the body is picked back up. So I called the medical examiner's office, and I spoke with the deputy medical examiner. And basically what he indicated to me, he said basically the medical examiner.
The. And what, when you
as
say
in
the,
what
the
head, the chief, head.
Okay.
Chief medical examiner, Dr. Graham, wanted to examine the body personally himself. Dr. Birch did indicate to us, he said, this is not a closed shop. This is an open shop. If you want, you know, we're not trying to hide anything, you know.
Cover up anything.
We're not trying to do that. He didn't use the word cover up, but he said this is an open shop. And he indicated the same thing to the doctor that we had to examine Jeremy's body and to do some necessary preservative, you know, evidentiary things, we believe. And it's interesting, you know, the examination from what I saw, because I had the unfortunate task of being there to, at least in terms of writing down information for, just writing down information, but I was there. I saw the body. To this day, I don't know how I made it through, but I did. That kid was shot five times in the back, And he was then turned over, and he was also shot in his front area.
I guess Moco ain't told no lie. His cops are trained to kill.
They killed him. They murdered him. They assassinated him.
The funeral for Jeremy.
The funeral for Jeremy is tomorrow at, it's at Mabity and Clara, the church right on the corner there. Matter of fact, it used to be an old polling site for us. The funeral services, we're asking people to get there about 10 a.m. It's right on the corner of Labity and Clara. You can only, if you're going correctly on Clara, you can only come off over St. Louis Avenue and turn right onto Clara. We're asking the community to come out to support this family. We're asking all strong black men to come out, to be there, to counsel the young brothers who we know will be at this funeral en masse, and so that they, if police are coming there to provoke, that provocation will not root. We want the family to have their time to funeralize their loved one in a peaceful environment.
And we're going to be talking more about this tomorrow. Irene, thank you for joining me this morning on the show. I'll be back with my guest, Scott Horton, who is an attorney there representing Saddam Hussein. Was it an execution? Was it a murder? We'll be back to talk about that.
Yet many are denied.
For the issues that matter most, it's AM 920 WGNU.
I'm Daria Aldinger. We could learn President Bush's new plans for Iraq this week. More from ABC's Ann Compton at the White House.
The long-awaited address to the nation still has not been officially announced. It is expected midweek. And it does appear that President Bush is on a collision course with a growing number in Congress who say an increase in U.S. boots on the ground in Baghdad won't work, isn't justified, and Congress might not support funding for a surge.
One Democrat, Delaware Senator Joseph Biden, calls the increase in troops a recipe for disaster. Hardly, says retired General Jack Keane, a former acting Army Chief of Staff who advised the president on the plan.
You're telling me that there's a capital city in the world, that the foremost military in the world, when it applies itself, cannot secure the population in a given city? That's just rubbish.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the president will not be given what she calls a blank check for his plan to boost troop strength. If you know a geek, chances are he or she is in Las Vegas for the Consumer Electronics Show.
If you listen to the folks who are here, voice over IP using the internet to make phone calls will be the wave of the future. Companies like Vonage and Skype are here. No long distance charges. You can call anywhere in the world for one flat low rate. But the problem is you need an internet connection. They even now have voice over IP cell phones that work off of Wi-Fi signals. But again, you can't make a phone call unless you have a Wi-Fi internet signal.
ABC's Alex Stone in Las Vegas. Also getting underway today, the North American International Auto Show. GM's CEO Rick Wagner says this is a make it or break it year for the big three.
This product momentum is beginning to build for us, product and technology, design recognition, stuff like that. So we've still got work to do, but from a confidence perspective, I think the GM team feels good.
GM got a nice boost to start the show. Media covering the event named the Saturn Aura and the Chevy Silverado the best car and truck of 2007. This is ABC News.
My cough isn't just a cough. I've got a stuffy nose, too. That's why Robitussin CF is my Robitussin.
I have a cough, and I have to hit the road, so I take my Robitussin with me. Robitussin cough gels.
I've got the flu, fever, body aches. That's why Robitussin cough, cold, and flu is my Robitussin.
Robitussin has formulas for coughs, for colds, for congestion, and for flu. So no matter what you've got, there's Robitussin Relief with your name on it. Use as directed.
Is your office in disarray? Can't find what you need? Well, Office Depot has great deals on file folders, binders, filing cabinets, shredders, and storage containers. Plus, we have over 800 calendars and planners to keep you up to date. So hurry in. Let Office Depot lend you a hand getting organized. Office Depot, taking care of business.
Whoa, Office Depot!
The skies of Texas are on the mind of a Canadian artist. Here's ABC's Steve Taylor.
An artist from Canada wants to float a 1,000-foot-long helium-filled banana over Texas. Cesar Sayers' plan is to build the yellow, bamboo, and paper artistic airship and launch it from Mexico so that it floats over South Texas 20 miles up for all to admire until it disintegrates. Sayers is raising money to raise his balloon and figures he'll need $1 million. When does the balloon go up? Summer 2008. How serious is this? He's got a website, www.geostationarybananaovertexas.com. Steve Taylor, ABC News.
All right, bosses, there's no reason any of your employees' jobs has to be a drag. Experts say adding a little fun to the workplace can increase productivity. One easy idea is to have treats for them. It can be as simple as cookies and milk. After all, you know, of course, when you need to keep it serious. I'm Daria Albinger, ABC News.
From the WGNU newsroom. Here's this hour's WGNU news update. I'm Peyton Colston. In Illinois, electrical utility rates will be frozen for another 3 years. The Illinois House okayed the freeze Sunday night in a 71-29 vote. Ameren IP rates in the Metro East had been expected to climb between 40% and 55% with the end of a nearly 10-year rate freeze as of January 1st. Ameren officials say the freeze will force layoffs and may lead to bankruptcy for the company. In other news, East St. Louis police and the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services are investigating head injuries received by a 3-week-old infant. Family members say the baby, D'Angelo Johnson, was injured at a family gathering Saturday evening at a home on Bond Street in East St. Louis. The family says the infant was struck by other children with a feeding bottle. Police have not commented on their findings in that case. And a semi-truck carrying new cars overturned on I-270 near Glen Carbon, Illinois, Friday evening. Investigators say they're not sure what caused the crash, which did not result in any injuries. The interstate was closed briefly while the wreckage was cleared. And that's this hour's update of WGNU News. For AM 920, I'm Peyton Colston reporting.
Good morning, St. Louis. 6 minutes after the hour of 8 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU, I'm Howard Morton. Let's take a look at this hour's traffic and weather. Westbound 40 between McCausland and Hanley. Look for slow traffic due to an accident. Shoulders blocked is at Hanley. It's involving 5 cars on the right shoulder, so just use caution. Eastbound 70 from Washington Elizabeth through Newhalls Ferry. Expect delays due to an accident at Newhalls Ferry. It's blocking the ramp and the right exit lane there. Eastbound 40 from 141 through Mason. It is slow. Eastbound 70 from Bryan Road through 79. Expect delays. Westbound 5570 at 4th Street all the way into the Poplar Street Bridge. It is a crawl this morning. Westbound 270 from Bell Fountain through New West Florissant. Look for a slow traffic, basically looking at the eastbound accident, the rubbernecking there. Northbound 270 at Gravelway and Big Bend is slow around the 44 interchange. And Route 3 northbound from the Poplar, from the 8th Street onto the Poplar Street Bridge, that ramp, you can expect some delays at this hour. Also, westbound Kingbridge traffic, you can expect a few delays there as well. Now, taking a look at your WGNU forecast for today, tomorrow, and Wednesday. Partly cloudy, windy with a high around 50 today. Mostly cloudy, windy with a low around 30 this evening. Tuesday, blustery, colder, mostly cloudy in the morning, then partly cloudy throughout the day, high around 40. Then on Wednesday, they're expecting sunny skies and 50 degrees. Currently, we have partly cloudy skies and 31 degrees. Lambert Fields reporting 32. Stay tuned for more of Liz Brown and the award-winning Wake Up Call. That's up next. We'll take another look at your traffic and weather in the bottom of the 8 o'clock hour. I'm Howard Morton for AM 920 WGNU.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air.
Power.
shot and was killed tonight. Remember that. I will never say that progress is being made. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. You pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that's below that the below me.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Feel me, brother.
But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever. More families in trouble, more and more people who need help but can't find it. A struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself.
We believe that all men are created equal, yet many are denied equal treatment.
So we say to all in this nation who would dare listen to us, black, white, Jew, Gentile, Asian, Latino, that we are brothers and sisters in a long and difficult struggle.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back to the Wake Up Call. My name is Liz Brown, and this hour we're going to have a discussion about the hanging of Saddam Hussein. We're going to have a discussion about the trial that led to the hanging of Saddam Hussein. News reports all across this country, all across the world, many, many news reports showed pictures of cheering people, much like the celebratory actions that we saw with the statue of Saddam Hussein that was lassoed and dragged to the ground. When our country engaged in its preemptive strike against the country of Iraq. News folks focused on the lassoing of the Saddam Hussein statue as symbolic of our defeat of Saddam Hussein and our democratizing the country of Iraq. Subsequently, of course, we found out that this was a staged act done for the cameras and that it took quite a bit to pull that heavy statue down and that the people that were involved in the celebratory action were actors, if you will. Not like a Sean Penn or a Denzel Washington actors, but used to convey a message that was not accurate. So my question, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, is the execution, was the execution of Saddam Hussein kind of like that pulling down of that statue? Was it designed to give a message, to say something about what is happening in Iraq? That is not true. Was the execution of Saddam Hussein a result of a trial? Was it the result of a fair, a credible trial? Was it a result of a trial that can withstand legal scrutiny? Was it? Or was it just another political act designed to be a provocative act to play into the political actions of a government that would be ours, that is attempting to justify its preemptive strike on Iraq. We're going to have that discussion with Scott Horton, Chairman of the Committee for International Law and Professor at Columbia University Law School. He's joining us from New York. My name is Liz Brown. You need to stay with me. We have much business to tend to.
Now Hall of Famer Wade Boggs, and I'd like to talk to you about another exclusive group that I belong to that has changed my life. I'm talking about the thousands of guys who, just like me, have decided to take control of their hair loss and regrow their hair permanently with the pros at Medical Hair Restoration. The best thing about this club is that you see the rewards every day. Having my hair back has made me look and feel younger than I have in years. And that's the ultimate vote of confidence.
If you're balding or thinning, Medical Hair Restoration, the nation's leader in microsurgical hair transplantation, wants to send you a free DVD package explaining just how easy and painless their hair replacement procedure is. Call 800-410-1832. That's 800-410-1832. Take control of your hair loss and get this free information package sent to you with tons of before and after pictures and testimonials. There's no cost, no obligation. Call 800-410-1832. That's 800-410-1832.
Connect Care, still connected to the community. Sometimes it seems like things are changing so fast that it's hard to keep up and hard to keep track. At Connect Care, we want you to know that yes, there have been some changes, and yes, we are still connected to the community. At Connect Care, we still have a retail pharmacy open 8 to 5 Monday through Friday. At Connect Care, we still provide transportation to patients that qualify. At Connect Care, we still provide access to in-house laboratory services. At Connect Care, we still provide some of the region's best board-certified doctors. At Connect Care, we still provide urgent care. And at Connect Care, we still see patients on a sliding fee scale. Yes, changes have been made at Connect Care, but we're still connected to you. Connect Care. Still connected to the community.
This is Alan Brainerd. Join me Wednesdays at noon for Design 411 on AM 920 WGNU. No matter where you live, no matter what your lifestyle, you'll find out how to turn your ordinary home into an extraordinary home. My guests and I will give you the 411 on everything from classic design to the newest decorating trends. Join me, Alan Brainerd, for Design 411. Every Wednesday at noon on AM 920 WGNU, where we discuss the issues that matter most to you and your home.
Anywhere in the world at WGNU.net, the award-winning wake-up call with Liz Brown.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back to the Wake Up Call. My name is Liz Brown. I have a guest on my show this hour, Scott Horton, Chairman of the Committee for International Law and professor at Columbia University Law School. He is joining us from New York to talk about the trial of Saddam Hussein, to talk about the subsequent guilty verdict given to Saddam Hussein, and also the subsequent hanging of Saddam Hussein. Scott Horton, welcome to the Wake Up Call.
Good morning, Liz.
How are you? I'm outstanding. How are you?
Doing fine.
Very good. Scott, you've made a number of trips to Iraq, have you not?
I have, yes.
And tell us about the reasons for those trips to Iraq.
Well, I was hired to defend journalists who were employed by some major U.S. companies, Associated Press and CBS News, who had been arrested by U.S. forces. And in one case, we actually had a trial of a CBS cameraman who was acquitted. And those proceedings went on in the Central Criminal Court of Iraq. So I became admitted to practice as an international legal advisor in the Iraqi courts.
And you had an opportunity to take a look at some of the things that have gone on in the trial of Saddam Hussein?
Right. I had no direct involvement in the trial, but I observed it while I was there, spoke with many of the lawyers who were involved with it, as well as some of the Americans who were involved in helping to prepare it, and spent some time studying it. It's a fascinating case. Of course, my students in, at law school also are spending some time studying it.
So can we start with the Iraq High Tribunal? What is that?
Well, it's a special court that was created after the U.S. occupation of Iraq for purposes of regime crime prosecution, that is, prosecution of crimes against humanity and other serious and high crimes committed by the administration of Saddam Hussein, including by Saddam himself.
Now, who practices within this Iraq High Tribunal?
Well, that, of course, is one of the very controversial issues, because what's going on here is something that follows from a tradition that was established at the end of the Second World War. We refer to it as the Nuremberg tradition, which is a system of trying individuals who are war criminals or who committed crimes against humanity. And that tradition launched in 1946. It's been carried forward and developed. And by and large, these tribunals have, following the tradition the U.S. established at Nuremberg, been international tribunals. And they're international for a clear reason, which is to avoid the appearance of victor's justice or revenge, to create a sense of distance, detachment, and fairness. Because it's very, very important with these proceedings, not merely that they dispense justice, but also that they're perceived by everyone who's observing them as dispensing justice. Now, what happened in Iraq is a very abrupt departure from the tradition. Because instead of establishing an international tribunal, a domestic Iraqi tribunal was created for this purpose. But it was a domestic Iraqi tribunal with the United States very clearly in the background at every stage.
But also with this newly constituted tribunal, we also have a new legal system, and yet they were supposed to be applying international law, but what kind of experience did the people that were supposed to be applying international law have with understanding or knowledge of international law?
Well, that's right. That's one of the major questions raised by those who've observed it. I mean, these proceedings were not applying so much domestic Iraqi law as they were applying law of armed conflict, law of war, international humanitarian law, and so forth. And they drew very heavily on Iraqi judges who were skilled in the Iraqi system, but really not particularly skilled or deep in the international law precedents. And on this point, they were supposed to receive, quote, advice, close quote, particularly from a group of American lawyers who were attached to the U.S. Embassy, a big team of U.S. Lawyers were involved, but I guess we don't see much positive evidence of that advice.
But if they are, if these individuals, Scott, are supposed to be practicing a type of law that they don't practice, and if they, in order to practice the type of law that they don't practice, they're getting advice from American advisors, who's really driving the bus here?
Yeah, well, that's a fair, very fair question. I'll tell you, the things that happened that gave most serious pause to people who were watching it were twofold. I mean, first of all, we have Americans constantly in the background dispensing advice, in quotes, as to what's happened. And, you know, the sense amongst Iraqis, lawyers, judges, and others on the ground, I interviewed a great number of people when I was in Baghdad, they referred to this as American marionette theater. That is, mm-hmm. They'd watch it on TV every evening, and they'd see Iraqis stand up and speak. But there was an assumption that there were Americans pulling the strings at every stage along the way. So that was one problem. And the other problem was that the judges kept being changed. I mean, a judge would make a remark at one point which would be viewed as giving too much ground to Saddam or one of his or one of his co-defendants, and that judge would just be cashiered or replaced. That happened twice. And both times it looked like there was a sort of political intervention. So I think a lot of people looking at this from the outside didn't really see the level playing field, the fairness that we really expect in international justice, especially in these sorts of trials.
And also with the requirements from the Iraq High Tribunal, they said that all of the judges, all of the prosecutors, all of the staff, and all of the principal defense attorneys for the accused be Iraqi nationals. What impact does that have?
Well, again, that eliminated the – well, first of all, of course, it meant involving people who were within the Iraqi process and subject to the risks of life in Baghdad today. The government doesn't really exercise effective control over the country, neither does the U.S. forces in Baghdad. The situation is very, very violent. So we had a great number of lawyers who were killed in the course of the process. We had judges who were killed and family members of judges. So bringing in outside personnel, international personnel, would have relieved some of that attention, some of that pressure, of course. But in addition to that, we had simply the question of expertise, and we had a lot of judges and a lot of lawyers who really didn't have the relevant legal expertise.
Okay, we've established that they don't have the legal expertise because this is international law. Let's talk about the resources. What kind of resources from the, before we get to the prosecutor, let's talk about the defense. What kind of resources did the defense attorneys have for defending their client?
Well, they had, they were able to hire counsel of their choice, and we had some fairly well-known individuals. Ramsey Clark, former U.S. Attorney General, appeared as counsel. A number of other prominent attorneys from the Persian Gulf, a European. There's one French, very prominent French defense lawyer, another prominent American defense lawyer who was involved. So they had quality people, I would say. On the other hand, did they have a very active role? The answer there would be not particularly, because the Iraqi system that's used is what we call an inquisitorial system, where the judges and prosecutors really run the court proceeding, and the defense counsel are more like what Brendan Sullivan, I think, once called the potted palm.
Mm. So in terms of the Iraqi defense attorneys, what kind of resources did they have as compared to the resources of the prosecution?
Well, they, of course, because Iraq is in a state of complete chaos right now, there are very fundamental things that needed to be done that they couldn't do, and that included identifying witnesses and bringing witnesses into the proceeding. It was extremely difficult for them to do things like that. Access to documents and records, they had some, but it really wasn't quite the level we would normally expect. So I think the...
What about interviewing their clients?
Interviewing their clients was greatly restricted. They were able to go in and talk to their clients, but it was not free access all the time.
How dangerous of a job was it to be the defense attorney for Saddam Hussein in an occupied Iraq?
You were immediately a target as a result of being involved in the defense team. And, of course, we had a number of defense lawyers who were, in fact, shot and killed.
And,
so
Scott,
it's not hypothetical.
I got to say this because I was a special public defender for a number of years. What kind of continuance do you think that I could have gotten if one of my defense attorneys was executed during the course of the trial? You think I would have been able to get a continuance or two?
You would have gotten a continuance of many months.
And how long of a continuance did they get once their defense attorneys were executed?
A matter of days.
And what kind of impact does that have on your defense?
It suggests that there's something of a railroad going on. It makes it very, very difficult because, of course, you may have someone who played a very strong role in preparing a defense, and if he's out, then all that's lost, and someone new has to be brought in and prepared.
And within days, you're supposed to be brought up to speed on we're talking about a trial that is prosecuting crimes against humanity and war crimes. That's no small case.
Absolutely. High-profile case.
And also, where did the defense attorneys live? Did they live in Baghdad? Did they have to drive back and forth to work to the trial every day?
Well, they had to have, for the most part, they were living in the Green Zone, which is an isolated, secured region. And even there, they were concerned. I mean, one defense attorney I spoke with told me he would take the battery out of his cell phone because he was afraid the cell phone was going to be used to track him and kill him. So conditions they operated under were extremely difficult, I think hard for Americans to imagine.
And in terms of, again, a trial of this kind is supposed to be fair, credible, and most importantly, as you said, able to withstand scrutiny. None of that is met under those conditions, just under those conditions.
I think that's right. I would say that the evidence that was presented against Saddam by the prosecution was very impressive evidence, including a number of things like a written order that he gave for execution of people in Dajail. So I think there was very, very powerful evidence put in against him. But on the other hand, the way the court proceedings were conducted, the removal and replacement of judges, the attacks on defense counsel, limitations imposed on defense counsel, all those things undermined a feeling of justice about the proceedings. And then we finally come to the execution, where I think the whole process was just made into some sort of farce as a result of what happened there.
And then also we cannot have a discussion about this trial from the legal perspective without having a discussion of the significance of this trial from a political perspective here in the United States.
That's right.
So let's have that conversation. We have to take a break. I'm talking to Scott Horton, chairman of the Committee for International Law and professor at Columbia University Law School, joining us from New York. My name is Liz Brown. This is the Wake Up Call. Stay with us.
Morning, St. Louis, 29 minutes after the hour of 8 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU. I'm Howard Morton. Let's take a look at your traffic and weather. Northbound 270 at Gravois and Big Bend, look for slow traffic. Westbound 40 between McCausland and Hanley, look for some delays due to an accident that's on the shoulder, and the shoulder is blocked, the right shoulder at Hanley. Eastbound 40 between Brentwood and Hanley, look for some delays as people are watching what's going on in the westbound lanes. Westbound 270 at Old Halls Ferry and West Florissant, look for traffic to be easing due to an earlier eastbound accident at New Halls Ferry. Westbound 5570 from 4th Street onto the PSB, look for traffic congestion cleared this hour, and all your other approaches are easing. Eastbound 40 between Maryville Center and Mason is starting to ease up this hour. Eastbound 70 at K and 79 is starting to ease up. And northbound Route 3, that ramp onto the Poplar Street Bridge, is starting to ease at this hour. That is a look at this hour's traffic. Now let's take a look at your forecast for today, tomorrow, and for Wednesday. Windy, partly cloudy day, high around 50 this evening. Windy. Mostly cloudy with a low around 30. Tuesday, blustery, colder, mostly cloudy in the morning, partly cloudy throughout the day, high around 40. And Thursday, mostly sunny with a high expected around 50. Currently, we have partly cloudy skies and 31 degrees. Lambert Fields reporting 31 as well. Stay tuned for more of Liz Brown and the award-winning Wake Up Call that's up next. We'll take another look at your news, traffic, and weather in the 9 o'clock hour. I'm Howard Morton for AM 920 WGNU.
Get a free Razor cell phone delivered free to your door. Don't want a free Razor? Then go to letstalk17.com and choose from hundreds of other free phones. Join 500,000 users who found the smartest way to buy their cell phones. Never pay retail again. At letstalk17.com, you can compare prices on phones and service plans from all the major carriers. Find the coolest new phone at the coolest price. Find the best current special offers. Read what folks have to say about their phones and plans. They actually rate and review their phones and service plans so you know which ones to pick. Do it all in the comfort of your own home. If your plan is ending, now's your chance. Try your new phone risk-free for 7 days with free 48-hour shipping. Letstalk17.com is the only way to get the absolute best deal possible. Right now, get a free Razor after $50 mail-in rebate. This is an exclusive online offer at letstalk17.com. New 2-year service plan agreement required. One-time wireless activation and early termination fees may apply. Go to letstalk17.com. That's letstalk17.com.
This is Dr. Laura Schlesinger. Join me weekday afternoons from 2 till 4 on AM 920 WGNU. And I look forward to hearing from you. If you have problems with a personal work or family relationship, call me at 1-800-DR-LAURA. That's 1-800-DR-LAURA for the issues that matter most. It's AM 920 WGNU. And for the personal issues that matter most, join me, Dr. Laura, now from 2 to 4 every weekday afternoon. Then go do the right thing.
It's the information you need to know about but can't find anywhere else on the dial. The award-winning Wake-Up Call with Liz Brown.
Oh, there have been times that I thought time coming, but I know a change gon' come. Oh, yes it will.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back to the Wake Up Call. My name is Liz Brown. This hour we are having a conversation about the trial of Saddam Hussein. We're having a conversation about the execution of Saddam Hussein with my guest, Scott Horton, Chairman of the Committee for International Law in New York and Professor at Columbia University Law School. He's joining us from New York. Scott, I have in front of me a number of faxes and emails that people have sent to me pertaining to the show that I'm doing with you. One of the emails has this headline that there was a $350 billion lynch mob with respect to the execution of Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein is hanged for his crimes. Who will hang Bush and Blair for theirs? How much does politics play into the trial, the announcement of the execution and the execution of Saddam Hussein?
Well, I think in a certain extent, trials of this sort, even the Nuremberg trials or the Tokyo Tribunal trials, have to be acknowledged to be political at a certain level. The question is, you know, is it politics at a very high level, or do we get down rolling in the gutter of domestic partisan politics? And I think one of the most troubling things about the Saddam Hussein trial were the connections that went on to domestic American politics. It was, you know, the administration attempted to use it for domestic partisan purposes to demonstrate progress that was being achieved in Iraq. And we saw this most clearly in the midterm elections just a couple of months ago now, when the announcement of the sentence for Saddam Hussein was literally scheduled precisely so it would be on the last full press cycle day before the American elections, so that the administration knew that there would be what, from the perspective of most, would be good news out there in the newspapers concerning Iraq on that last day before the election.
And even as to the announcement of the execution of Saddam Hussein, it didn't come from the court. It came from the political body, right?
Well, it was made by the Prime Minister's office,
right?
As well.
And that's significant, isn't it?
It is. And I think that added, you know, within Iraq and the Middle East to a very broad perception that this was not justice as it was being administered. It was just sectarian violence, the same sort of thing you read every day in the newspapers of Sunnis attacking and killing Shia and Shia attacking and killing Sunnis. And the actual description of the execution when that film footage finally got out with this crowd of thugs shouting Muqtada. Now, Muqtada al-Sadr, of course, is a murderer. I mean, has been accused and labeled by the United States as a murderer. He was a wanted man for many years, and it appears that his henchmen were brought into the room to carry out the execution.
Well, can we
shocking.
Can we talk about that, too, Scott? Because who had control of the execution? Did America have control about this? And if so, then wouldn't this administration be responsible for who got to attend?
Well, those are very important questions, because the fact of the matter is that Saddam was captured by U.S. forces, and he was held right up to the eve of his execution by a special forces unit called Task Force 134, which is commanded by Major General Jack Garner. So General Garner had custody of Saddam and turned him over to the Iraqis only at the last minute. But that meant that, you know, custody and control over Saddam himself was in the hands of the United States. The U.S. was absolutely in a position to use that physical control to deal with the circumstances of the execution, and clearly didn't do so. I mean, allowed this spectacle to be carried out.
And in terms of who got the body after the execution, where'd the body go? Who got it?
Well, that's actually been a subject of some mystery, but it appears that he was taken back to Crete, an area near his hometown, for burial. But it has not been public, and his exact whereabouts are not known, because I think the government of Iraq doesn't want there to be some big public demonstration surrounding his funeral and burial.
And I've heard talk also that the United States military was in charge of that, dictating to the family when they could come get the body, how they could come get the body, and actually even so far as to say where the body could be buried.
That's absolutely correct. My understanding is exactly the same. That is that the U.S. forces in Iraq dictated all those things.
And what's the significance of the U.S. forces dictating that?
Well, I think it suggests who actually exercises police power in Iraq, because the position of the government of Iraq itself is extremely weak. So, clearly it's the U.S. who does things in any case that is difficult. But on the other hand, it suggests that the U.S. controlled this process, de facto controlled it, even though all the reports and the official statements were that this was done by the government of Iraq.
And when we look at the trial itself, one of the things that a person is entitled to in an international court is to have the ability to examine the witnesses against them and be able to obtain the attendance of the witnesses. Did any of that happen?
Well, their system is a different system from ours because it's inquisitorial, which means the judge directs which witnesses are to come, and the judge usually conducts the examination of the witnesses. A lot of the examination is done before the formal trial system, so they have a somewhat different tradition from ours. But I think the key point to make is the one you're making, that system disadvantages the defense counsel. They don't have nearly the latitude. They don't have the ability to introduce the sort of evidence that they would want to introduce. But I think, Liz, it's also important to view this from the perspective of victims. And there we've got a big issue with the execution being carried out, too, because there were two trials. There's this Dujail trial, and it's on the basis of the verdict from that trial that he's been executed. But there was also a second trial called the Anfal trial. Now, I think for most international observers, that was the far more important case. That was the case that involved the accusation of genocide against the Kurds. And I think there were certainly hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq who were eager to see that trial played out, the evidence put in, to be able to come to closure on those issues.
But also when we look at it, Scott, the reason that this administration, or the drum that this administration, the drum beat that this administration continued to make was Saddam Hussein killed the Kurds. We've got to go kill him. We've got
That's
to get
right.
into Iraq.
That's right. And so I think a lot of people are asking, so why are we not having that trial? The trial's been mooted. And, of course, one of the concerns we've got is we know that some of the evidence that Saddam was going to put in on that trial had to do with his meetings with Donald Rumsfeld. He had two separate meetings with Donald Rumsfeld, and the then U.S. ambassador in Iraq has made statements that during those meetings Donald Rumsfeld gave him assurances that he shouldn't be so concerned about the American expressions of worry about the attacks on the Kurds, that really didn't matter, that the U.S. was going to stand beside him and support him in his war with Iran. Of course, that evidence, had it come in, would have been extremely embarrassing, not just for the administration in the United States, but specifically for Donald Rumsfeld, who was the actor in all of that. So by executing him very, very quickly, they've avoided that from happening. And I think that raises a lot of questions, again, about timing and why this was done the way it was done.
And the selection of this particular trial as opposed to the other one.
Exactly.
And I guess the argument could be, at least the question could be raised about the learning curve of this administration. Didn't we just have a trial where, wasn't it Mikhlishev that brought up the same time, that involved other people as well? The other international tribunal that took place where implications were made of other people like that would have been made of Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, I think that's right. And generally the power of the court has been used to limit availability of witnesses for this to happen, and so forth. So, it's clear that there's been a pretty heavy degree of manipulation of the trial proceedings themselves to protect the interests of the administration.
And let me get to a couple of callers here. Carphone, you have a question or comment for my guest, Scott Horton.
My comment is it was just a kangaroo trial. It was a total travesty of justice. And we have mass murderers right here in this country, and they need to be dealt with. I believe that's why they killed Saddam Hussein. And I just look at it as just murder, Liz, just straight up murder. They didn't want him to testify about where he got his chemical weapons, who was financing him. Most of us who done any search on the subject know that the Americans are up to their neck in the blood of the Iraqi people, and that George Bush is a mass murderer, and he ought to be tried and hanged too.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. With respect to the charges that get someone to an international tribunal like this, Scott, what are some of the kinds of charges that would get somebody to an international tribunal?
Well, I mean, specifically we have two major categories. One are grave breaches of the laws of war. So during wartime, you have abused or mistreated or killed prisoners in violation of the war. That particularly has always been taken as a basis. And the second are crimes against humanity, and that is included, if we look back at the things that happened at the Nuremberg Tribunal, the genocidal practices against Jews and other minorities who were the subject of discrimination there, the establishment of the concentration camps, but also wars against aggression. That's under the sixth Nuremberg Principle. And, of course, one of the concerns a lot of people have based on what is subsequently developed in Iraq is how is the Iraqi war not a war of aggression?
A preemptive strike.
Based on what we've heard, because not only have the excuses that were used at the time proven false, people can go in and do things based on a good faith belief that turns out to be wrong. Then it's not a war of aggression. But if it turns out that people at that time knew that they weren't true, it's a war of aggression. And I think that's the area we're standing in right now. It's a very, very serious case.
And it also contributes to the question of that is the fact that it's preemptive. That in and of itself suggests that nobody has done anything specifically to you.
That's right.
We're going to take a break. I'm talking to Scott Horton, chairman of the Committee for International Law in New York and also professor at Columbia University Law School. He's joining us from New York. We're talking about the trial and subsequent execution of Saddam Hussein. My name is Liz Brown. Stay with me.
Previously on the Sloan Ranger program.
How dare you create an argument for public health that exempts the casinos? You wouldn't do that. If we had an avian flu epidemic in St. Louis, would you exempt the casinos from those regulations?
Pretty good. No, you wouldn't.
Yeah, so it kind of betrayed the argument on its face.
For the smartest talk on radio, it's the Sloan Ranger Show, weekdays at 5 o'clock, only on AM 920 WGNU.
School, church, civic, and other nonprofit organizations often have tight budgets. At WGNU, we understand that and remind you that we can help. If you know of a nonprofit group that would like WGNU to help promote events and ongoing programs free of charge, just send a fax with all the information to our public service department at area code 314-454-6609. Requests must be submitted 2 weeks in advance of any event. WGNU Radio reserves the right to edit or reject any submission because of time constraints and objectionable or commercial content.
Hi, this is Lethea Owens with a Motivational Moment. If you always do what you've always done, then you will always get what you've always got. If you want something that you've never had, then you must do something that you've never done. If you always think the way you've always thought, then you will always get what you've always got. So please join me on Mondays from 1 to 2 for Motivational Mondays, where your dreams become reality on AM 920 WGNU.
Big Brother is watching, and we're watching Big Brother on the award-winning Makeup Call with Liz Brown.
Welcome back to the Wake Up Call. My name is Liz Brown. My guest this hour, Scott Horton, chairman of the Committee for International Law and professor at Columbia University Law School, joining us from New York. We're talking about the trial of Saddam Hussein and the execution of Saddam Hussein. Let me get to some of the callers on the line here, Scott. Dan, good morning.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to mention,
I feel like the crew behind George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, the people who were involved from the beginning of this thing, have a lot to say for history, or as the years grow by, what things are going to be said about them and what their involvement in this situation was, and I don't think it's going to be very pretty. I think that they have had undue or over, and they have over influenced George Bush. Not that I think he's, I mean, I think he's like a terrible role model for children and everything, but besides that, their influence over him seems to be grand, and it's unbelievable to me. And I want to know really what history's gonna have to say about those two and their involvement in Iraq and Iran since the beginning of the Reagan administration. And how this all connects together. And history, I think, will connect all this together. I guess that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. And Scott, in terms of what the world sees right now as a result of this execution and the trial of Saddam Hussein, how does the world view us?
Well, I think the world's got forming a pretty uniform view. Everywhere I've looked, it's being assessed extremely negatively. This has been viewed, especially in Europe, as a betrayal by the United States of American values, because the United States established the notion of Nuremberg, this notion of fair and impartial administration of justice with respect to war criminals operating on a very high level, and what the U.S. has done in Iraq is making a mockery of our own values and traditions.
And the fact that we had this video, Scott, this video of an actual human being hung, what kind of impact does that have? And what does that say about us? And also, what are your thoughts on how we got that video?
How we got the video? Well, I think it's what was on the video that was really shocking, that it showed what really was a lynch scene rather than the administration of justice. That was completely shocking. And on the other hand, maybe it wasn't shocking because it was so consistent with everything else that had gone on. I think a lot of people saw that, and they see in that the ratification of all the prejudices they'd already formed about this process. But I think another thing we ought to be focusing on right now is the fact that Dick Cheney and a group of neoconservative advisors pushed this war. They pushed Bush into this war at the beginning. And now when, their false advice and their misrepresentations are completely obvious, who's driving Bush's decisions now? We're going to get a major speech this week, and it appears he's going to be putting on the table the same prescriptions from this same group of neocons who misled before. Now, that is shocking.
And I cannot help but think that given how much control this administration has down to the recent discovery that now the Secret Service is not even going to allow us to see the records of who goes into the White House any longer. The amount of extraordinary control that this administration has on things, and even more so control in Iraq, how on earth could we have gotten a video like this out if they hadn't wanted it? And if that is so, could an argument also be made that it was designed to be provocative in a way that helped the administration?
Well, I think it was definitely designed to be provocative in a way that inflamed the situation in Iraq,
which helps the administration.
Maybe that's a possibility, but I don't know. I'm also a subscriber to the law of unintended consequences. And I think with this administration, almost everything they touch seems to go wrong.
there you go.
I don't think that's the way they necessarily intended it. We have some information that came out over this weekend, Long Report and the New York Times, saying that key people in the administration in the last 48 hours before the execution realized that this was going to be a disaster and tried to stop it, but they weren't willing to intervene the decisive way that would have been necessary to bring it to an end. So, that's a possible, that seems to me a very, very plausible explanation for what happened.
And doesn't it speak to the extraordinary absence of a learning curve with this administration, that it was only within the last 48 hours that you realized this was going to be a problem?
Well, that's absolutely right, because I think anybody who's studying what's going on within the Iraqi government and around al-Maliki, would have expected exactly this. So.
Let me get to some more callers here. Dimitri, do you have a question for my guest, Scott Horton?
Yes, I do. Good morning, Liz, and welcome back.
Thank you.
The statement I have for Scott is simply to say this, that The energy that's been the energy behind the execution of Saddam Hussein. If we were to restore confidence in the international law, then that same energy should be used against war criminals on the winning side. And the Americans have a plethora of war criminals, starting with World War II, Vietnam, Korea, Iraq, and Afghanistan. So how can we restore confidence in the international law if they only go after the losers? Thank you, Liz.
Good question. Scott.
Well, I happen to have very strong feelings about the conduct of World War I and the Korean War. I think the U.S. Really did a very, very good job in the way it conducted itself, consistently with principles of international law and the law of war. But of course, we have to note that a lot of those principles change subsequently, and countries only live up to the rules as they exist in that time. And those principles have evolved quite a bit. So I don't think the U.S., certainly I don't think the U.S. political leadership was guilty of war crimes in the Second World War or the Korean War or even the Vietnam War. I'm sure you've got a lot of callers who will disagree with me about that. But I think the Iraq War is really something very different and something very serious. And, you know, one of the biggest concerns I've got coming out of Iraq has to do with the way detainees were treated. And that, for international law purposes, has always been a major concern. That is, we give people and we give armies a lot of latitude in dealing with people with guns and bombs, but once they're disarmed and they're held as prisoners, the hand of protection comes down on them, and they're sheltered to some extent. Those fundamental rules have been cast aside. That's a cause of big concerns, I think.
And my guest in my next hour is going to be John Miller, who's the national coordinator for the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network. And we're going to be talking about what Gerald Ford did and Henry Kissinger did with respect to East Timor. And I guess the caller, Dimitri, was raising the question because even if it's not what they did in World War II or Korea or Vietnam, there are actions that our government has engaged in that amount to the same types, or that the argument, at least the argument, could be made that somebody needs to be held accountable for this, and that our hand was present in it. And again, the East Timor situation to me speaks to that as well. Can't we not at least raise the question of whether or not the United States could engage in these types of acts?
We need to start with Congress, I think. You know, Congress should be holding hearings about all this, and I think that's going to happen.
Let me get to another caller or two. Michael, do you have a question for my guest, Scott Horton?
Yes, ma'am. I know it may be a stupid question. How and why the Bush administration was able to keep the trial out of The Hague? And number two, hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
If Saddam was at the Hague trial, would have been able for him to cut a deal to talk about, to put charges against the administration.
Thanks for your call and question.
Well, the United States took the position from the outset that we weren't going to have an international trial in The Hague. I think the reason for that was pretty clear. That is, the U.S. wanted the death penalty, and the majority of the nations who participate in the Hague process have rejected that. So we wouldn't have had the possibility of capital punishment.
And what does that say? Before you get to the second part of his question, Michael's question, what does that say about what does that say to the rest of the world?
I think it says that the U.S. puts a greater value on the death penalty than it puts on international cooperation, which is a real slap in the face to the rest of the world. And I think, you know, at this point, there are a lot of people in the U.S. who support the death penalty who have come to the conclusion that this really wasn't a smart way of approaching the issue. So I think right now we're at the point of seeing with relative clarity that those judgments made back 3 years ago and 4 years ago were mistakes. We clearly should have gone the international route, even if it meant no death penalty.
And the other part of his question is kind of answered by that.
I think so. I mean, you know, it certainly is not up to Saddam to raise charges, but he, in presenting his defense, you know, could certainly have laid the groundwork for a lot more inquiry, I mean, particularly into the involvement of Mr. Rumsfeld. But that would be, you know, up to others to do in our international process.
Cynthia McKinney, on her last day or so in Congress, filed articles of impeachment against George W. Bush. Does this, the execution of, and the way that the trial was prosecuted in Iraq, does that, will that, could that possibly weigh in on charges of impeachment?
Well, I think it shows bad political judgment, but it doesn't to me suggest an impeachable offense. Because remember, in the end of the day, we've got the execution being carried out by the Iraqis, and we have an Iraqi court system. So the U.S. position was formally detached. But I think what went on in Abu Ghraib and other things that happened in Iraq, you know, might very well provide basis for articles of impeachment.
Scott Horton, chairman of the Committee for International Law and professor at Columbia University Law School, thank you so much for joining me on the show this morning.
Well, thank you. It's a great pleasure being with you and your listeners.
Take care now. Listen, folks, this is Liz Brown. In my next hour, I will be joined by John Miller. John Miller is the National Coordinator for the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network. And we're going to be talking about, Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush in the year 2007. But we're going to go back to the year 1975 when the players were Gerald Ford and Henry Kissinger. We're going to talk about Gerald Ford and the death of tens of thousands of East Timor citizens when we come back. My name is Liz Brown. This is The Wake Up Call. Stay with me.
You were born with power.
Some very sad news for all of you, the people who love peace all over the world. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. I will never say that progress is being made. If you pick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. If you pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that's below me.
I think I'm hearing revolution.
But the hard truth is that not everyone.
For the issues that matter most, it's AM 920 WGNU, Granite City, St. Louis.
Here's the latest from ABC News. I'm Daria Aldinger. A new development that could affect the debate on a real hot-button issue, embryonic stem cell research. Here's ABC's Pam Coulter.
Researchers have collected stem cells from the amniotic fluid of pregnant women, and Wake Forest Medical School's Anthony Atala says they have many of the advantages of embryonic stem cells.
We can get a collection of stem cells that can grow very rapidly and have the potential to become many different tissue types.
The cells can morph into brain, bone, and muscle tissue and are more stable than adult stem cells. While some scientists say they won't completely replace the need for embryonic cells, groups opposed to research involving embryo destruction are hailing the news. Pam Coulter, ABC News.
Another heated issue is the future of U.S. troops in Iraq, and President Bush is expected this week to formally announce plans to send another 20,000 service members there. Delaware Senator Joseph Biden tells ABC's Meet the Press that this would be a big mistake.
This is a prescription for another tragedy.
But retired General Jack Keane, a former Army Chief of Staff, says it's the best choice right
now. Once we clear the Shia death squads out, the Al-Qaeda, the Sunni insurgents, as we've done before, we will put a force in 24/7 that stays in the neighborhoods. It does not go back to its bases.
Keane advised President Bush on the plan. This is a big week for the trade shows. Two are getting underway. One, the North American International Auto Show. ABC's Dean Reynolds is there.
What you are seeing at the Detroit Auto Show this year is nothing less than an attempt by Detroit to reestablish a connection with the American consumer. They're showcasing a wide array of vehicles, cars, trucks, and concept vehicles in a clear attempt to appeal to the broadest possible audience before it's too late.
The Consumer Electronics Show is underway in Las Vegas. ABC News Money Scope, the Dow is down 35 points and the NASDAQ is off 4. This is ABC News.
My cough isn't just a cough. I've got a stuffy nose, too. That's why Robitussin CF is my Robitussin.
I have a cough and I have to hit the road, so I take my Robitussin with me. Robitussin cough gels.
I've got the flu, fever, body aches. That's why Robitussin cough, cold, and flu is my Robitussin.
Robitussin has formulas for coughs, for colds, for congestion, and for flu. So no matter what you've got, there's Robitussin Relief with your name on it. Use as directed.
Is your office in disarray? Can't find what you need? Well, Office Depot has great deals on file folders, binders, filing cabinets, shredders, and storage containers. Plus, we have over 800 calendars and planners to keep you up to date. So hurry in. Let Office Depot lend you a hand getting organized. Office Depot, taking care of business.
Whoa, Office Depot!
Some good and bad news about where your energy bill is concerned. You can save on what you put in your car, but you might end up paying more for food in the long run. ABC's Gil Fox explains.
Gasoline prices are supposedly headed up again, a rise of about 3 cents a gallon over the past 3 weeks or so, say the analysts. And that may be one reason why enthusiasm for ethanol is at an all-time high. The corn-based fuel seems like a fine idea when gas is $2.50 a gallon and more, but ethanol has driven the price of feed corn way up. That makes it more expensive to feed cows, pigs, and chickens. Farmers say any time you increase the price of ethanol fuel, you up the price of feed. And long term, that may mean what you save at the filling station, you may wind up paying at the supermarket. Gil Fox, ABC News.
Here's another reason to watch your weight, gentlemen. A National Cancer Institute study says while obesity may not increase your chances of getting prostate cancer, if you do get it, it would increase your chances of dying from it. Daria Albinger, ABC News.
Now, the local report from the WGNU Newsroom.
With another WGNU News update, I'm Peyton Colston. In the news, local fire officials are warning the fine print in Missouri's new minimum wage law could cost their departments millions in overtime. Officials say the law rescinds exemptions that allow firefighters to work long shifts without overtime and could potentially force fire districts to cut services or seek higher taxes. Fire departments are exempt under federal law from having to pay overtime. Some fire officials say they might file a lawsuit or ask the legislature for a quick solution. In other news, a Mizzou professor has a new book on the landmark civil rights murder case of Emmett Till. Dr. Clenora Hudson Weems says Till, a 14-year-old from Chicago lynched in rural Mississippi in August of 1955, is as important a figure as any in the civil rights movement. She calls Dr. Martin Luther King the father of the movement and Rosa Parks the mother.
But you must also look at the one who was responsible for making that movement come to the forefront, and that was Till. So Emmett Till is the child of the movement. It's a trinity. It's the father, the mother, and the child.
Dr. Clenora Hudson Weems' new book is called The Definitive Emmett Till. Professor Weems was a recent guest on WGNU's Roster Resolutions with Carlos Vinson. I'm Peyton Colston, and that's an update of WGNU News.
Good morning, St. Louis. 6 minutes after the hour of 9 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU, I'm Howard Morton with a look at this hour's traffic and weather. Northbound 55 between Delore and 4500 South Broadway. Look for two left lanes blocked as they're doing some road maintenance operations. Eastbound 44 from 109 through Lewis Road, they're down to one lane. And that's basically, they've got some road work going on there as well. Southbound 170 from the Galleria Parkway through Highway 40, look for it to be closed one lane this evening beginning at 7 p.m. The second lane will close at 9 p.m. and that will go on through 5:30 a.m. tomorrow morning. Other than that, there are a few construction projects going on, so just give yourself a break, slow down, and use caution through work zones. Now let's take a look at your WGNU forecast for today, tomorrow, and for Wednesday. Partly cloudy, windy with a high around 50 this evening. Mostly cloudy, windy with a low around 30. Tuesday, blustery, colder, mostly cloudy in the morning, becoming partly cloudy throughout the day with a high around 40. Then on Wednesday, mostly cloudy. The expected high is around 50. Currently, we have 33 degrees and clouds. Lambert Fields reporting some clouds and 33 degrees as well. Stay tuned for more of Liz Brown and the award-winning Wake Up Call. It's up next. We'll take another look at your news and your weather in the 10 o'clock hour. I'm Howard Morton for AM 920 WGNU.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Tell me, brothers, stop the sound. I think I'm hearing revolution in the air.
was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
I will never say that progress is being made. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. You pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that's below me.
But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever, more families in trouble, more and more people who need help but can't find it.
A struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself.
We believe that all men are created equal, yet many are denied equal treatment.
And so we say to all in this nation who dare listen to us, black, white, Jew, Gentile, Asian, Latino, that we are brothers and sisters in a long and difficult struggle.
This is Mondays at 9 with Liz Brown, where we take a closer look at issues and people shaping our world and how they affect us. Once again, here's Liz Brown.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to this week's edition of Mondays at 9. I was watching on television, like many of you did, the ritual that followed the death of a 93-year-old man by the name of Gerald Ford, a former United States president. George W. Bush was quoted as saying, and also I think it would be fair to assess that he was expressing, to the best of his extent, sadness in the wake of Ford's death, saying that he was a great man. The newly elected chairman of the majority, the speaker, Nancy Pelosi, also expressed respect for what she deemed, and I quote, Ford's fair and reliable leadership. I'm a fan of history, and I am a student of history. And I believe that if we're going to examine people and tell the tale about them, that we need to have a full and clear examination. We need to take the time to engage in a full and fair and thorough examination of the of a person's entire record. Well, we're going to take a moment on the Mondays at 9 here to talk about December 1975, the Indonesian invasion of East Timor in December of that year. And Gerald Ford and Henry Kissinger's role in that. Because it's ironic that, I don't think that there are any coincidence historically. I don't think that there is such a thing as a historical coincidence. Shortly after the death of President Gerald Ford, his death was followed up by the execution of Saddam Hussein. And George W. Bush said that Iraq has rid the world of a tyrant. I don't think anybody is immune from examination or comparison. When we examine the record of Gerald Ford and in light of the deaths of so many East Timor citizens, should we be raising, can we raise the same question of whether or not Gerald Ford was no different than a Saddam Hussein? Let's have that conversation. We're going to talk about this with the coordinator for the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network, John Miller. He's joining us from Brooklyn. My name is Liz Brown. Mondays at 9 will continue after this break. Stay with us.
Decent Guy Don, the original conspiracy hunter. You know, the guy that keeps you up to date on all the good guys and the bad guys out of the Council of Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, the Illuminati crowd, and assorted other characters who are squeezing the life out of our great American country. Tune in every evening to hear the thunderous crash as I pull the linchpin from the foundations of the House of the New World Order as it crashes down. That's 7 p.m. Monday through Friday with the conspiracy hunter right here at WGNU 920 a.m.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Davis, home mortgage consultant with Wells Fargo.
And I'm Jacques Land with the 100 Black Men of Metropolitan St. Louis.
And we're the host of Let's Get Wealthy, investing in more ways than one. We'll discuss home ownership as a means to build wealth, create positive personal finances, stabilize our neighborhoods, and acquire the American dream.
Tune into our show, Let's Get Wealthy, every Wednesday at 11 a.m. to get some food for thought during your lunch hour. Sponsored by the 100 Black Men of Metropolitan St. Louis, Wells Fargo Housing Foundation, and produced by the Platinum Group.
For the past several years, you've heard WGNU's community calendar of events going on in and around the area. Ever wonder where the information comes from? The majority of it comes from our listening audience. If your nonprofit organization would like help promoting its events and ongoing operations free of charge, send all necessary information to calendar@wgnu.net. Please send the correspondence 2 weeks prior to any events. WGNU reserves the right to edit or reject submissions for reasons of time and content.
A voice for those that should be heard. This is the award-winning Wake-Up Call with Liz Brown. This is Mondays at 9 with Liz Brown, where we take a closer look at issues and people shaping our world. Once again, here's Liz Brown.
Welcome back. Welcome back. My guest of this hour for Mondays at 9 is John Miller, coordinator for the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network. He's joining us from Brooklyn. John, good morning.
Good morning to you.
How are you?
Not too bad.
Very good. John, can you... give us a little bit of background here. Can you talk to us about who is East Timor?
Well, East Timor is a country, an independent country now, that was a former Portuguese colony. It's a few hundred miles north of Australia and shares an island with Indonesia's West Timor.
And when we talk about the colonization of East Timor, it wasn't very long ago.
Well, Portugal had a revolution where they overthrew their dictatorship in 1974. And as part of that process, Portugal began preparing its colonies for independence. The major ones were in Africa, Angola, Mozambique. As part of that process, the Timorese themselves began organizing and discussing how their independence might look and the mid-70s, the rhetoric from at least the dominant political party in East Timor was heavily leftist, and that scared the very right-wing anti-communist Indonesia and didn't please the U.S. too much either.
And let's talk about these groups in East Timor. It began with at least two?
Well, there were two dominant political parties. One favored some kind of continuing relationship with Portugal, at least initially, the UDT. So it's more moderate. And then there was Fretilin, which was more leftist, as I said. There were also several other political parties
backed by Indonesia. But those were the two dominant parties. And when we talk about the UTD, they really, it was more about the elites and a lot of the folks from the senior Portuguese colonial administrators. Would that be fair to say?
No, they were more from the traditionally dominant families in East Timor. Fretilin, which also came from an elite because the Portuguese didn't really educate the Timorese too much or economically develop it, came more from actually from the Portuguese, the civil service, the military, and those that had been educated either in Portugal or by the church in East Timor.
And when we talk about Indonesia at that time, what did Indonesia look like?
Indonesia is one of the largest countries in the world, predominantly Muslim, and was basically your right-wing, military-dominated dictatorship. President Suharto seized power in 1965 in a coup against the then-president there was the independence leader in the 40s, and claiming that the communists were about to take over. And as part of that process, it's believed up to a million Indonesians, real, alleged, and real and alleged communists were murdered, and large numbers of people were imprisoned as well.
And when we look at the Indonesian government, what was their interest in East Timor? Why did they want it?
There's debate about that. I think primarily they, internally kind of generated this fear that East Timor would become or be communist. And secondarily, and I don't think that's true, but secondarily, more a concern that, right on their doorstep would certainly be a country that was more democratic than they were. And a fear that even if Timor wasn't communist, they would have good relations with dominant communist countries in the world at the time, like China and the Soviet Union.
So here we have in the 70s, East Timor wanting their independence and being free of the colonial rule that they were under. Initially, did the Indonesian government say that it was prepared to support their independence?
Well, Indonesia's official policy, and one thing Indonesia also was and continued to be even under Suharto, was a leading member of the non-aligned movement at the time, which was an anti-colonial, a movement of recently independent countries for the most part promoting decolonization, was that East Timor should be independent. And in fact, the foreign minister of Indonesia in, I think it was early 75, actually gave a letter to the Timorese saying that Indonesia's policy was to support an independent East Timor.
But also at the same time, they were also looking to back what they call to be pro-integration organizations.
Right, they created a pro-Indonesian, pro-bring East Timor into Indonesian political party. They worked with the UDT particularly to kind of bring them into that camp. And the Indonesia's military was actively preparing and making contingency plans for an invasion from at least late 74 on.
And how about the Timorese Popular Democratic Association? What was their response? Weren't they an organization that was basically...
That's Apodeti. That was a...
Right.
pro-Indonesian, explicitly pro-integration political party, very small.
But they didn't, when you have the Fredlin Party and they had the support of the people, when you bring in these other organizations or other parties, they didn't have the support of the people.
Yeah, Fredlin, I think by agreement, everybody agrees Fredlin was dominant. UDT certainly had substantial support. The others were quite minor.
What was the role of Lisbon in this?
In the aftermath of the overthrow of the dictatorship in Portugal, most of Lisbon's attention was on getting its own house in order, mm-hmm. building its own democracy, and that the military there had overthrown the dictator, so, you know, sorting out how dominant the military should be in Portugal and what its policy should be. But there was a general agreement that Portugal had to get rid of its colonies, and there was debate about how quickly and which ones were ready for independence or not, and I think there was also a general sense East Timor was the least ready. But in many ways, sort of the neglect of East Timor was part of Lisbon's policy as well. They did try to deal with it, but were very much had their attention at home and were in no position, certainly militarily, to block any kind of invasion of East Timor should Indonesia launch one.
Now, Suharto talked a lot, used the word communist a lot, and when you look at some of these conversations between he and our president, the president at the time, and other officials, that the word communist came up a lot. Where was America in 1975, on the issue of communism, and where were we with respect to Vietnam, and what is the significance of that when we look at our relationship, or where we were with respect to that, and our subsequent response to the request from Suharto about East Timor?
One, the U.S. had been defeated in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. It had pulled out, all those scenes of the helicopters picking up people on the top of the U.S. Embassy, that's from April mm-hmm. 1975.
So we were just recently.
Right, yeah, so those wounds were quite raw.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that was happening was that Ford was following up on the Nixon's opening to China. In fact, Ford's visit to Indonesia in December 1975 was a stopover on the way back from a trip to Peking where he met with Mao.
And in terms of the issue of communism was still on the mind of our president in this country in terms of the policies that it was exercising.
Yeah, no, the Cold War was still very, very active. And, and the fear of communism in the U.S. government. And the rivalry, particularly between the Soviet Union and the U.S., was also quite active.
So let's talk about what led up to this stopover by Gerald Ford and Henry Kissinger. What happened prior to that stopover? What was going on in East Timor?
Well,
had we had a mock invasion yet?
The Indonesian forces had begun pushing against that border between West Timor and East Timor. They had actually had troops within East Timor on the border area. They were calling them Timorese and saying they were just freedom fighters they were sponsoring. In October of 1975, five journalists who were working for Australian media had been murdered in a border town of East Timor because they had gone to cover these incursions. The Australian government had done almost nothing to protest those murders, which was another signal to Suharto.
And wasn't Suharto kind of hoping that the murder of those journalists would raise the interest of what was happening and work in his advantage?
I'm not so sure he saw it that way, but he certainly took the fact that there was no protest from, and the journalists themselves, citizenship was New Zealand, Australian, and British,
mm-hmm.
That none of those countries, actively, and all of them had to have known what had happened or some close approximation of what happened. None of them had vigorously protested the murders, called for any independent investigation, you know, more or less expressed understanding and kind of blamed the journalists for doing their job.
And didn't we have, in February of 75, a mock invasion engaged in?
Well, the Indonesian military, as I said, was, you know, like militaries do, making its plans, rehearsing how the invasion might take place. And, yes, that had happened during the year. You know, it was very clear from documents that have since been declassified that the U.S. was quite aware of what was going on, what was planned, and knew it also had the leverage to stop it if it wanted to.
We're going to continue this conversation with John Miller, coordinator for the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network. My name is Liz Brown. This is Mondays at 9. Stay with me.
Washington of the St. Louis office of Edward Jones, located at 200 North Broadway downtown, inviting you to tune in to Radio Free St. Louis for the WGNU Stock Market Recap, weekday afternoons immediately following the 3:30 traffic update. Find out how your investments are doing and how the numbers on Wall Street are affecting you. That's the WGNU Stock Market Recap with me, Mitch Washington, weekday afternoons at 3:30 on Radio Free St. Louis, AM 920 WGNU.
Recently in St. Louis, some changes were made in healthcare providers, and we at ConnectCare want you to know that sometimes change can be good. ConnectCare, still connected to the community. ConnectCare is now your specialty care clinic hub. If you or your loved one is dealing with kidney disease, you can contact one of ConnectCare's renal specialists at our renal clinic, dedicated to improving the quality of life and providing optimal care for patients with chronic and acute renal disease. At ConnectCare, we have 14 specialty care clinics to serve your healthcare needs. Our specialty care clinic hub includes specialty clinics dealing with arthritis, ENT, GI, orthopedics, and a women's specialty clinic. At ConnectCare, the physicians and staff at our specialty clinics are committed to the philosophy that the best care is provided by those with the greatest commitment to their community. ConnectCare, still connected to the community.
Just like a well-built house needs a good design and plan, so do our lives. This is Sandy.
And this is Bobby.
Two life coaches. Please join us as we take your questions about designing your life. We'll discuss life planning, following through, and the obstacles that get in the way.
This is your weekly chance to get some answers you've been looking for. We hope you'll join us on The Design Life on WGNU every Monday afternoon from 4 to 5.
I hope you never lose yourself.
Informative, educational, provocative. This is the award-winning Morning Wake-Up Call with Liz Brown.
I got something I want to talk about. Y'all listen here. The time has come to air my feelings. Yeah. There's just so much confusion going down. I'm not the kind to be complaining. But sometimes you got to stand out from the crowd.
This is Mondays at 9 with Liz Brown, where we take a closer look at issues and people shaping our world. Once again, here's Liz Brown.
Welcome back to Mondays at 9. My name is Liz Brown. Our conversation today, our conversation is with John Miller. He's a coordinator for the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network. He's joining us from Brooklyn. We're talking about Gerald Ford and Henry Kissinger's green light to Indonesia's invasion of East Timor in 1975. And John, welcome back. Can you take us to, I was looking at some of the information out here on East Timor and some of the, you made mention of some of the recently declassified memorandums, conversations, transcripts. Can you talk to us about a meeting that took place in July 5th, 1975 at Camp David?
Well, that was the first meeting between Suharto and President Ford with Henry Kissinger, who was Secretary of State, was also present.
What was significant about that meeting?
Well, that Suharto raised the issue of East Timor. I think it's crucial that, you know, East Timor is not high on the U.S.'s foreign policy radar, given what had been going on in Indochina with China, you know, and elsewhere in the world. But Suharto raised the issue and basically said that the only way to deal with East Timor was to integrate it into Indonesia, which meant take it over, and called Fretilin, the leading pro-independence party in East Timor, as communist.
And what I found interesting about looking at these recently released documents is that it makes the point that you're saying that this was not high on the list because it was like the last three or four paragraphs of what Suharto talked about.
Right. In both meetings with Suharto, the one again in December, it was, you know, towards the end of the meeting that the issue was raised. And in both cases, the issue was initiated by Indonesia.
And it's such a political conversation because the transcript reads, "With this is Suharto speaking, with respect to Timor, we support carrying out the decolonization through the process of self-determination." That was a political statement because right after that, they only give three options, and the only option that they say is the one where we get to take over East Timor.
You know, if by political statement you mean, I wouldn't quite call it a lie because I think even at that point, Suharto preferred something a little more subtle and peaceful than what Indonesia ended up doing. But yeah, I mean, the only option that Indonesia saw, and I think in the U.S., I think essentially agreed to, if you read other documents from that period, was an Indonesian takeover of East Timor.
And also there was the characterization, John, of this as a communist concern. Was that a calculated act? Do you think that was a calculated act on the part of Suharto, given where we were with Vietnam and communists?
I suspect he actually believed it. But, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Indonesia, like a lot of countries around the world, knew that that was a buzzword to catch the U.S.'s attention and gain their support. And vice versa for other countries, a way to gain Soviet support.
Because Suharto says very clearly, the problem is that those who want independence are those who are communist influenced. That was not true.
No, I mean, certainly not at that time. No, they were José Ramos Horta, who's now prime minister, was Fretilin's foreign minister at the time. I think he quite accurately characterizes himself as a social democrat, and sort of what inspired him to work for freedom was John F. Kennedy. Others were, you know, had other influences, but certainly it was a diverse party, and any Marxist or Maoist or whatever elements, you know, probably were just a handful of people in this very broad-based party.
And one of the things that Suharto made a comment about that I was wondering if I could get your impression on, he said that he mentioned the archipelago principle, and he said that the purpose is to force ourselves in as a unified nation without any territorial ambition. What's the significance of that statement?
Indonesia itself is made up of thousands of islands. It's made up of the former Dutch territories, primarily colonized by the Dutch in that region. Indonesia geographically is wider than the U.S. And some of those parts of Indonesia were and are not happy having been forced to join it. So Indonesia has always wanted to stress the need, and part of its official name is the Unitary Republic, this notion that it gets its legitimacy from being unified, from being made up of these former Dutch colonies, and for covering, for the most part, and there are some exceptions, it shares an island with Malaysia and Brunei, and being made up of all the islands in, and shares another one with Papua New Guinea, but being made up of all the islands in that area. I think it's crucial that Indonesia's claim is that it's made up of the former Dutch colonies, and East Timor was a Portuguese colony, and Indonesia, even after it took over, never claimed that it had a historic claim to East Timor, but that, you know, it had been invited in by political forces there, and that that's where it got its legitimacy for the occupation from.
Now, these documents that I'm looking at today, the memorandum of the conversation between Ford and with Henry Kissinger there and with Suharto, these were recently released documents. Can you give us a little background on that? How significant, how many of these documents were released and how significant are their release?
Well, thousands of them concerning East Timor and Indonesia have been released over the last 7 years or so. Some are part of a normal process of declassification. You know, as foreign policy documents get older, they're more willing to release them. A number of them are result of a project by the National Security Archives in Washington to deliberately, you know, request through the Freedom of Information Act that these documents be declassified and, you know, and help fill out the history of that time.
And the history of that time, according to Henry Kissinger and Gerald Ford, with respect to East Timor, was what?
Gerald Ford really didn't remember it. Journalist Alan Nairn interviewed him, I think it was sometime in the 90s, early 90s. You know, Ford said he really didn't remember what happened. Henry Kissinger has given varying explanations of what happened. He's been pressed more and more publicly on the issue, I think, than Ford. He does a lot more public speaking. From it was just an afterthought as we were walking to the plane, to we thought it would be like Goa, which was a Portuguese enclave in India, which India just basically one day walked in and peacefully took over. But, you know, kind of acting like they were taken by surprise and it was no big deal and that they didn't know how bad and bloody it would be. This is more recent statements that East Timor became was on its road to real independence finally.
And the America could have, I mean, there was a problem with Indonesia doing anything to East Timor. They had to have United States approval on this on some level because of what?
Well, the U.S. was Indonesia's major weapons supplier. Suharto's rule within Indonesia was based on his military. So, and his military was trained on these weapons, used them, received other U.S. training, and was very dependent on the U.S. on that score. The problem was that under the agreement by which the U.S. supplied those weapons, a treaty signed in the 50s, they could not be used for what was called external aggression. They could only be used for defense.
And that's a significant portion. That's a significant line, isn't it?
Yes. And, in fact, after the invasion, as Kissinger was sort of strategizing with his other State Department officials on how to deal with this, he very explicitly said, can we construe this as self-defense and make the case that way? And Indonesia, and I think what kept Indonesia from invading earlier in a State Department, the talking points actually for Ford's meeting with Suharto refer to this, was Indonesia's fear that they would be cut off. And that was, I think, the main reason also why the U.S. was encouraging Indonesia up until December 7th, up until this meeting in Jakarta, to deal with the Timor issue a little more subtly. Yes, they could take it over, but they should find a way to do it peacefully.
And let me get
that was used.
Okay, let me get to a caller here. Barbara, you have a question for my guest, John Miller.
Yes, Mr. Miller, and good morning, Liz.
Good morning.
I had, thank you for your clarification. A lot of the points that you brought up I had understood. And I just wanted to know that what is the makeup racially of the East Timorians that were killed and slaughtered that day? And also, I had heard that Amy Goodman and Scott were also almost killed when they invaded and crowded them into that cemetery and shot them all. Could you clarify that for me?
Just the second part first. Alan Nairn and Amy Goodman were in East Timor in November 1991 when there was a massacre at a cemetery during a memorial service for a student activist who was killed. And they were beaten at the time. Alan had his skull cracked. The Timorese they're at sort of the crossroads between, should we say, Southeast Asia and the Pacific, so they're largely sort of a mix between Melanesian and Malayan. They do look different than a lot of other Indonesians do, but and there's also, because of the heavy Portuguese influence, there's, you know, a lot of people of mixed race, and also some fair amount of African influence, because one thing that the Portuguese would do was that, you know, when people became uppity in their own country, they would sort of exile them to elsewhere, and Timor was about as far as you could send somebody from one of the African colonies.
That they were also colonizing.
Right.
All right.
Exactly.
We will continue this conversation with John Miller, coordinator for the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network, joining us from Brooklyn. We're talking about how Gerald Ford Henry Kissinger gave a green light to Indonesia's invasion of East Timor in 1975, and new documents that reveal that. Stay with us. We'll be back with more of Mondays at 9. I'm Liz Brown.
Prizes awarded on WGNU will be held for pickup at the radio station for 30 days. After 30 days, all items become the sole property of WGNU Radio to be disposed of at our discretion. In the case of event tickets, tickets will be held for 30 days or until the date of the event, whichever comes first. Prizes must be picked up at our studios, which are located at 265 Union Boulevard in St. Louis, unless otherwise specified.
Hi, this is Judy Moskov. Join me for a Gardener's Notebook every Monday at noon. We'll be talking with gardening experts and sharing information that you need to know. Get the latest dirt on everything from tomatoes to trees. That's a Gardener's Notebook every Monday at noon.
Hi, I'm Laurie Fulkerson. Join me right after the 10 o'clock news here on AM 920, WGNU.
Starting your day with information you can't get anywhere else. It's the award-winning wake-up call with Liz Brown. Mondays at 9 with Liz Brown, where we take a closer look at issues and people shaping our world. Once again, here's Liz Brown.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Mondays at 9. I'm having a conversation this morning with John Miller, coordinator for the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network, joining us from Brooklyn. And John, take us to that meeting in December. with that stopover with from Gerald Ford and Henry Kissinger?
Well, they met. There was a long agenda having to do with trade and foreign policy issues, etc. And then pretty much at the end of the meeting, Suharto raised the issue of invading East Timor. The U.S. knew that there was an invasion ready and, in fact, had signaled. And
with our arms. These are the guns we gave them.
Right. Yeah, estimated 90% of them, might even be higher, of the weapons used came from the U.S. As I said, we're going to be used illegally, not just in violation of the treaty I talked about, but also of international law. I mean, international law is very clear on violating acts of aggression. So Suharto raised the issue asking, Suharto said, we want your understanding if we deem it necessary to take rapid or drastic action. Of course, rapid and drastic action was in the works, in the immediate works. And Ford's answer was, we will understand and we will not press you on the issue. We understand the problem and the intentions you have. So very couched, diplomatic talk, giving the go-ahead for what became an invasion and occupation that slaughtered up to 200,000 people.
And Henry Kissinger stressed that the use of U.S.-made arms could create problems, but then he added, it depends on how we construe it, whether it is in self-defense or a foreign operation. And not whether or not it was illegal, but whether or not it would be interpreted as illegal.
Yes, like much politics and foreign affairs, it's all about the spin.
And he also said, it's important that whatever you do, it succeeds quickly. What's the significance of that statement?
Well, Kissinger's concern, I think, was how Congress might react. I think in this case overestimated the concern in Congress, at least the initial concern in Congress about East Timor, and that under U.S. law, if Indonesia invaded, there was a requirement that the U.S. cut off, at least for a while, Indonesia's weapon sales, which is the main concern here, of course, not East Timor. And so I think the hope was that if it all got dealt with quickly and any criticism and uproar would just die out,
because
business as usual could go on.
Because what Henry Kissinger knew was that even if there was a decision made by Congress like that, there were still plenty of weapons and plenty of things that Indonesia needed in the pipeline. So the pipeline would continue.
Yeah, right, the pipeline wouldn't be cut off. And yes, and that should be more than enough for Indonesia to take control of East Timor. I mean, this request is very ironic because nothing about it was quick or quiet.
Well, it's kind of like here with the Iraq situation, we will be greeted as liberators. There was one historian that said at the time about the East Timor invasion, the whole business should be settled in about 3 weeks.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that was the Australian, I believe, from a right estimate. And the East Timorese put up far more resistance
like the Iraqis,
than I think anybody anticipated.
Like the Iraqis, well, and Afghanistan. I mean, it's like...
in many ways, a similar miscalculation.
So
on Indonesia's part, and but it was at great cost, that resistance to the East Timorese.
So one of the last things that I thought was very interesting that Henry Kissinger said was that whatever you do, make sure we're not here when you do it.
Right. This was a request that they wait till the president's plane was out of Indonesian airspace territory before the invasion was launched, and in fact, it was. They waited almost to the exact moment, literally hours after Ford left the invasion start.
And talk to us about the invasion. What was the cost?
The East Timor set up a truth commission, or the UN did, when it was administering East Timor after its referendum, and that the truth commission estimates between 100,000 and 180,000 people were killed either through violence, the violence of warfare, or starvation induced by the invasion. Other estimates have been as high as 200, 250,000. It's very hard to know because in many cases whole families were wiped out, so there's sort of nobody to keep track. And most of that occurred in the initial years after the invasion, so under the Ford and Carter administrations.
So, and when we put those numbers in perspective of how many...
out of a population of 600, 650,000 people at the time of the invasion.
So it could be a third of the people.
Yeah, a third, which proportionally would be one of the, probably the worst genocide since the Holocaust, since World War II.
So what happened? Who won?
Well, to go back to just the leverage the U.S. had, which was the cutoff of Indonesia's arms supply. So there was this massacre that the journalists, Amy Goodman and Alan Aaron, witnessed in 1991, and that was filmed by journalists, photographed and filmed by some British journalists, and had other Western eyewitnesses like Amy and Alan. And that brought East Timor back on the international agenda. There was tremendous pressure within Portugal for it to step up its diplomacy as the, under the UN, Portugal was the administering power officially, if not in fact, and was East Timor's representative in a sense in negotiations in the world community. It caused stepped up activity at the UN. It caused groups like ours formed at that time. So there was a lot of additional grassroots pressure. And within the U.S., it led to, over the course of the 90s, a gradual cutoff of military training and some weapon sales to Indonesia. Initially, a program called IMET, which is basically what funds the School of the Americas, which your listeners may be familiar with, which only deals with Latin America, but was cut off for Indonesia. Some jet fighter sales were canceled. And that was part of gradually building global pressure on the U.S., Australia, Europe, Japan, you know, Indonesia's main patrons, if you will, to settle this question because, as I often say, you know, Indonesia was important. East Timor really wasn't in kind of the global scheme of things, and the problem was East Timor was now getting in the way of this much more important relationship between Indonesia and the U.S., Indonesia and the rest of the world. And Suharto was pushed out of office due to an economic crisis primarily in 1998, the spring of 1998. And sort of all the justifications why East Timor should remain part of Indonesia sort of fell by the wayside. The main argument we used to run into when we would work on the issue in those years was, you know, East Timor couldn't be allowed to break away because Indonesia would then fall apart.
And we had other issues or other concerns with Indonesia. We had military concerns with we needed Indonesia from our government's perspective.
Yeah, well, we see them as a counterbalance to China, for example. We have huge economic interests in Indonesia, oil, natural gas, gold, copper all come from Indonesia in huge quantities. Produced by U.S. companies.
And there was a, jumping ahead a little bit, there was an East Timorese Commission of Inquiry into Human Rights Abuses that occurred between 75 and 99.
It was East Timor's Truth Commission, right?
Right. And they called for reparations.
They called for reparations from countries. They basically said the U.S. had bore substantial responsibility for what happened. Called for reparations, not just from the U.S., but from the weapons companies that profited from selling to Indonesia. They called for countries not to resume military relations with Indonesia until the Indonesian military showed a respect for human rights, which we interpret as by seeing some of their generals locked up for what they did in East Timor and elsewhere in Indonesia. And And the reason they could call for going slower on resumption of military ties is because the U.S. finally did cut off its military relationship in 1999 after a UN referendum was held. That was the result of all that pressure. Post-Suharto pressure ended up in Indonesia agreeing to a referendum that was held. After the referendum, the Indonesian military set about doing what it had promised, destroying East Timor. About 70-80% of its infrastructure was destroyed, hundreds of thousands of people displaced.
And they still didn't win.
And that just led to increased pressure. That was when the U.S. President Clinton actually cut off the Indonesian military, finally.
And are there similarities between this and Iraq?
Well, I think one big difference is that in East Timor, the international community was welcomed, and sort of the main plea from many East Timorese is, when is the UN going to come? They sought, if not Western military intervention, Western political intervention. And, you know, but they didn't look for Jakarta to be bombed to see, to help overthrow Suharto. They wanted it, you know, they wanted political and other pressure on Jakarta. They saw the Indonesian people as victims as well, where I think in Iraq, you know, all those issues got muddled in a much more factionalized society. And that's why you see such resistance to the occupation.
And John, where do we go from here? What is it that needs to happen?
Well, you know, East Timor is a small country, very poor country, the poorest in Asia, very high infant mortality, maternal mortality, and has many problems of post-independent countries, including severe political differences within among themselves. And so, you know, we continue to advocate for justice for these Timorese, for some accounting by the U.S., by Indonesia and other countries for what happened to East Timor, continued support, economic and other